name. I think the future and the education authority and anyone else is, I'm not mentioning, please forgive me, but you are most welcome. I think, honourable members, we must start the meeting. We've got a bit of a lengthy agenda on our side, but with your assistance, I'm sure we'll be able to go through it. As I welcome you today, honourable members, to, I think, the last meeting for this term of Parliament, before we rise to go to the elections, the local government elections, allow me to take this opportunity, honourable members, to remind you that today, some years ago, a very important decision has been taken, were taken, and that decision was to make sure that Africa unites. So you are reminded that we are celebrating Africa Day today, and that wherever we are, whether it's in education or anywhere else, that we remember that whatever we do so in pursuit not only of our country, but also in pursuit of the continent. And that should be our drive that we always have. Having welcomed you and reminded you about Africa Day, any apologies?
Thank you, Professor. We received an apology from Professor Hubisa. We also received apologies from the Minister, as well as the Deputy Minister, Tanisha.
The apologies having been given to you. The remainder of the agenda, honourable members, with your permission, is we'll start with a briefing of the department. There are three different briefings that the department will do. Then on our side, we have the minutes and the reports that are outstanding, and the third report. And I don't think we have any announcements, and I don't think we have any correspondence, but nevertheless, they are there. Are we in agreement with that agenda, honourable members? The mover and many seconders. Thank you very much. Without any further ado, DJ, I'm going to hand over to yourself to start the briefing to the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. Honourable members, my colleagues in the department, officials from the construction sector and people in the nation. I assume, Chair, that the briefing first would be on the student activities on campus. There are briefing notes which we give over to the but I'll be talking to the issues as a department, not necessarily going to each and every aspect of the briefing notes in detail, and looking at specific universities that are affected by these disturbances. The University of Hotel, there the SRC led a peaceful protest on the 17th of May 2016 and presented a memorandum of demands to the management. The students were unhappy about quite a number of things, but in the main it was the question of student debt and financing which affected, according to the version of the institution, about 158 students, which in the afternoon of that day, the management promised that they would have dealt with the matter at the close of business in that particular day, and as well the question of the meals. During the protest, there were some activities in respect to closing the gate of the Alice campus, setting the tent in which the centennial celebrations were supposed to take place, alight, looted and vandalized some buildings in the institutions. But the SRC of the university distanced itself from all those activities. There are students who were identified in respect to those activities, and the institution is attending to that matter. So the department, we gave a hand to the institution in order to stabilize the situation there. We met with them, went through the issues, we worked together into ensuring that we minimize any destruction to property, vandalism that may occur, working of course with the SARS in some instances. And these developments were as of up to the 20th May 2016. So at the present moment, after the centenary celebrations, there isn't anything thus far in respect to updates from the institution. Because we normally engage in the due processes and request institutions to give us authorized report in respect to the developments, because we don't want to talk on speculations and assumptions. So we'll be updating then our reports by the end of this week. The second institution is University of Johannesburg, Auckland Park Kingsway campus, which was formed. And there the destruction was on computer laboratories, including equipment which is used to conduct career assessment and guidance for students and prospective students as well who would attend to that institution. We were told then by the institution that the damage is estimated at around 100 million in that auditorium, because 1,000 seats is used for exams and other activities. As a result, all those activities, including the writing of exams, had to be shifted to other venues by the institution. Thus far, there are no reasons at all that the institution is aware of as to why that took place and by who. There were investigations of which there were some clues that the institution was following together with law enforcement agents in identifying the culprits. At NMU, that is Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University, its community members who blocked the entrance of Missionville campus in the previous week. But here, the institution has got no clue as to what are really the basis in respect to what could be needed from the institution. It looks, it's just this delivery protests that are taking place in that community, and it affects the operations of the institution in that particular campus. Rhodes University is the issue which relates to rape allegations that are taking place in the campus, of which the management is working on them together with the constituencies with regard to the appropriate actions that should be taken. But what was disturbing on the 12th of May in the morning is on the floor at the south entrance to the council chamber in the main building, there was fire that was started, which was only put off. But the institution is working on the matter. Valley University of Technology, I think it's an institution which, amongst all these institutions, is very affected to the point that it had to consider closing the institution. The demands really of the students that were put to the attention of the management. The management responded to all those demands in writing. But the Secretary General of the SRC destroyed the response of the management and didn't give it to other students to make a consideration of what the management is saying and thereafter make a determination of whether the management is attending to the demands they put forward or not. And the, amongst other things that the students are demanding is the appointment of certain service providers without due regard to the university procurement process. So students are insisting that certain service providers should be preferred over others, and that should not go through the normal procurement processes of the university. Those service providers they have identified, they must just be appointed, which in terms of the practices, the processes of the institution, that is not working. And the other area of demand was that the university should withdraw criminal charges and list the suspensions of students facing serious allegations of damage to property, grievous bodily harm, fellow students and security personnel as well as staff, and the banning of university property in general. So the university was saying, no, all those processes have to follow two processes. And if anyone of the students thinks is not guilty, they have to prove that in the due processes that the institution has rolled out. I think University of Cape Town, it was at the beginning of the year, but they've arrested the situation. There's nothing happening at the present moment in that institution at the present moment. Then, lastly, this is the University of Free State, but in respect to the at Kwakwa campus, but in respect to all those issues, the management, the vice chancellor, they met with the students, because the students were raising the issues that relate to the end goals that needed to be filled. The transformation of all classes as well as hostels, and free Wi-Fi on campus, amongst others. But the institution is attending to the matter, and the meeting with the SRC and the Vice Chancellor took place on the 17th of May, 2016. And according to the SRC, the meeting was a success, and they had agreed that the university will reopen on Wednesday, 18th, 2016. But for that week, there were no planned academic activities, but the processes of normalizing the activities of the institution started in operating. So the long and short of it, Chair, is that these are the institutions that had some incidents of one form or the other, but relatively, the management as well as council, they are under control. We haven't, as a department, did anything outside the framework of the law. We're working with the institution in ensuring that stabilization is brought to bear on the institutions. And we're working quite cooperatively together. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, DG. Honorable members, I'm going to open up to yourself for reflections on the report, Honorable Killian, and then I go right down.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, thank you to the DG. Thanks for navigating your DG, making sure that the institutional autonomy of the institutions could remain intact and they could deal with these matters on their own. Now, just to say, if you are receiving feedback with regards to two aspects. One is, we noticed that some of the campuses have been closed down, and usually it is affecting, especially for instance in the case of the Kwakwa campus, for instance, and also to a lesser extent the whole University of Technology. it's affecting students that come from far, and some of them are really innocent in this whole exercise. How would they be afforded an opportunity to further their studies and not to lose out on the academic progress and the examination? Is there anything in place that the department is assisting these institutions with? Because ultimately, usually you have a small group of rebel rousers and it impacts on the broader student community and on their ability to further their studies. So what would you do in that case? And then, obviously, in some cases, such as the concern with regards to Wi-Fi, I think that is reasonable. What is the department coordinating with the necessary government departments to see to what extent our universities could, in fact, all have access to Wi-Fi, you know, the rollout of internet and access to Wi-Fi. We believe that is one of the critical elements to assist students to also do their own research, etc. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Kashi.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, I've got a number of comments and some questions on this update or report from the department. The first, Chairperson, is to say that I'm very disappointed in this kind of report for the committee. What I would have expected from the department, DG, is not to miss the woods for the trees. We've got a report here on the actual student action and the response on that student action. But really, we need to be looking at what is the root causes behind these actions. So, for example, if it's at this specific university, these are the issues that are being raised. This is what the institution is doing, or has done, or will be doing in order to address those issues. Are they legitimate issues? Are they not legitimate issues? What is the department doing to provide support where the institutions cannot handle it themselves, etc., etc.? I think that's the kind of report that we'd like to see so that we can put solutions rather than just trying to crowd protests. That in some cases, yes, are a bunch of rubber houses, according to Honorable Killian, and maybe outside elements that can cause disruptions. In other cases, that's not really the situation. They're not all the same across all of these instances. So I'd love to, the Chairperson, get that kind of a report, perhaps even in written form from the department in the future, so that we can adequately understand all of the issues and what is actually being done and where they are legitimate and where they are not legitimate and so forth, so that we can understand that better. The second point is really, and you know, Honorable Killian's self-proclaimed naughtiness aside, what we'd like to see is leadership from the department, the minister and the deputy minister. Now, one doesn't have to go and take over universities to show leadership. At least students, and I've been with the students over the last week as a matter of fact, want to see, or the minister to be seen to be doing something, or at least be there to support legitimate issues, or to be on the ground at the institutions, or the deputy minister, and so forth, and to be speaking out on some of these matters as well. Otherwise, it seems as if the minister just doesn't really care, or the minister isn't abreast of the situations. The last information we received, and we're not even sure if this is true, is the minister's in Monrovia. I'm not sure if that's true. Maybe you can confirm that what he's doing in Monrovia while the institutions are burning. But at least the minister could be on the ground saying, this showing some leadership, this is what is possible, this is what is not possible, this is what can be done, this is my advice and guidance to institutions, this is my advice and guidance to students, and at least that leadership vacuum would not be present. Because in some of these instances, the students have lost confidence in their management and in the councils, because the councils have also failed in their governance responsibilities in the past, at least in some of these instances. Then I want to just touch on the university report, because I was there last week on the ground. And I think it's a bit different from some of the other cases. There were no burnings, buildings that were burnt at the University of Fort. And if you look at what was looted in the main, it was where the textbooks and stationery was being housed, and food, and the VIP tent, for example, food for VIPs at the centenary and so forth. And I think this is very telling, because it's already May, toward the end of May, the 24th of May today. And up until this last week, students that were accepted for NASA's, not that they were unfunded students, they were funded students. I know they met with them. were accepted financially, but they still have not been allowed to sign loan agreements to receive any allowances. So examinations are next week, by the way. And they do not have textbooks. They do not have meals. They do not have stationery. And we expect students to pass, and if they fail, they will be locked out of getting public funding for their studies or the rest of their lives. So that's the way the system is set up. And I think this is a massive indictment on the way that oversight is being done on the administration of public funds, and in particular master's funds, and where the inaction in the past is coming back to haunt the department and its public entities in this regard. Then, I want to talk about what spurs the silence as well, because we must condemn any form of violence or illegal activity. But as the department engaged with the police services, or at least that department, on how these incidences are responded to, I was horrified when the police at Fort Hare went into residences. Students that, by the way, were not even part of the protest, they were busy, they were sitting in their residences because they didn't want to be part of that. And they started gassing students in residences. One of the students that I was with there was shot with a rubber bullet in his chin. It's a massive gaping wound. He was not even part of any of the protest. He was standing outside his residences because they were gassed to the residences so they'd get out, and then they were shot as they came out by this police. That only makes people more angry. And you are not really dealing with the situation. It's like those police just want to start shooting everyone like they are playing some sort of a computer game. And it does not quell the situation, it only seeks to inflame. So maybe some sort of engagement on how these things are responded to. I think there can be a better way of these situations being handled by the law enforcement authorities. I want to talk about Rhodes University, because I did meet with Dr. Mabizela. I made a visit to Rhodes after the protest that clashed at Rhodes. And what was very interesting, as I met with the station commander as well, was that these barricades were being set up to block the roads. Massive barricades. You can't carry those things. They, I don't know how many times those things weigh. And when the police would remove them, within 5 minutes, those barricades were back there as well. It is impossible, you've got people there on the ground, it is impossible for that thing to have been led or at least resourced by students themselves. And there were some outside elements, at least as roads, that were involved. And we've seen that trade at some other institutions as well, where they're getting support, at least logistical and resource support, from the outside. And there needs to be better controls of access. I know roads are a bit different because it's a town type of university, but there need to be some better controls in terms of access for the outside elements. We know that it's an election year. We know that some organizations want to make themselves more relevant than what they are. And we know that there's some grassroots organizations in communities as well that have issues that also want to use those opportunities to cause some chaos. For example, remember, this is not just about students. When there was a centenary on last Friday, communities were burning roads between Slandon and King William. Okay? It wasn't just about students. We've got mass unhappiness across the country in communities where people are unhappy. They feel they're not being heard. There are 30 service delivery protests a day. And there needs to be a holistic approach to how these matters are dealt with, because it's not just in our education sector. It's not just in this environment that we are operating in. But it's across the board, and it just seems as if there is no real leadership, number one, being shown. It's as if something must be burned first before there's a response, or before someone comes and speaks to people, and that is setting a wrong precedent, and it's teaching people the wrong ways of how to voice their issues. And it seems as if also the responses by the law enforcement agencies are not coherent and consistent, and they are really exacerbating the situation. Thank you, sir.
Honourable Mkadini, followed by Honourable Kekana, followed by Honourable Ozori, and followed by Honourable Mtun. I think I've got all our hands now, no?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me welcome the update that we have been given by the DG about what is happening in the university. I just want to check with this new University of Mpumalanga, because it said that it is not, the workers are not working there, since the learners are not also attending. What is happening at the measures that put in place before this fire there? Thank you.
Thanks, sir. No, I also want to thank the department for the report, because some of the things that Honorable Kasima is saying are actually debatable. I mean, the department is giving us facts. As to what we as politicians do with those facts, that is a decision for us after discussion. You see, the department comes and says, this is the case. Somebody will say, no, you are biased. That's not the case. I've got this, a different story. I mean, like the report that Kasim has given, Honorable Kasim, I mean, if he says the barricades at the rest of roads, they were beat, outsiders, how does that help out? You can't arrest outsiders. You've got to. If you came with names, at least you could go and arrest those people. So the same thing applies to what you just reported. It is open to discussion and further investigation, and probably even have resources to investigate further. But I'm just saying, depending on the aspect, and we can decide. If you think there are shortcomings and it needs further investigation, then we should refer it to relevant and appropriate structures that can do investigation. The second point, I really don't think it is fair. Actually, the minister, when students passed on from University of this, I saw him go to the hospital. I also was aware that he was at the funeral. I can put many instances where one minister is trying to round up so many protests and bannings that are happening in the country. But remember that his work is not as to, as fortunate as Kasimu can just go to Forte. He's got other commitments. This is going to Moravia. I don't think it is our responsibility to give him a list of countries he must do and try and define, give him a job description. We can do oversight on education, but as to the broad activities that are enforced within his jurisdiction, and if you have preferred countries, I don't think we'll allow you to predetermine where he must go. For as long as we are satisfied that he's doing his work within the country. And the countries are interlocked. If you're doing South African educational work, it will also involve the global community. My question, Chair, is the bomb that exploded, I'm worried now about bombs. The bomb that exploded at UJ, the Auckland Park campus, was it, what, are we able to detect what type, is it professional, is it an amateurist, just a few naughty boys gathering and doing a petrol bomb and throwing it in, or are we seeing a case where now professionals were expecting to happen, because if that is the case, then it means this protest are taking a different dimension. Thanks.
I think the Honourable Member has forgotten that I recognised her.
Thank you for the briefing. It's good to have a briefing. I mean, it may not be as comprehensive as we would like, but to know what is going on, I think, is very important, and I would like to ask if we could bring in a briefing of a sort, given that the university are in a bad way, and TVET colleges. Increasingly, this does seem to be spreading to TVET colleges, and I think we need to know what's going on there. My first point is, I'd like some comment from the department on Professor Habib's point, where he said he was not happy with the quality of policing in this situation. It echoes also Honourable Kasim's point. We know that our policing system does not do crowd control very well, especially in rural areas where perhaps there haven't been the train. And I was wondering whether this committee could not have a joint meeting with the police committee to get a briefing from them on how university unrest is being handled. Is the most enlightened form of policing being used? A, so that you don't create, you know, a worse situation than already exists. And B, if you do have criminal actions, are they being properly followed up on? And are people being charged, and are they being prosecuted?
Professor Habesi said not. So that would be my first question. Second one, could we have some clarity on who is paying for the damages in each case? Just very briefly. Thirdly, where is the minister exactly? Could we have a response on where exactly the minister is and why and what she's doing there? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I want to also thank the briefing from the department and further say that if we really want to get more information, I think we can even invite the institutions themselves in order to that are affected in order to get more facts on what has been presented to us. One is very worried at the fact that what is common amongst whatever is happening, it is the burning of the institutions. And then you get a sense that maybe there is, there's a word that I can want to use, we are really worried. We are not saying that the issues that are raised by students are not legitimate, they are, but it takes me to what the President has said for Chair, that the students really need to relook at what they are doing and at whose interest are they acting. Whatever is happening, lines for communications must be open. There must be communication that is taking place. Really, this one, it's not working. It's not on. And the South African Police Service must help us. People must be apprehended. They must go to jail. If they need to be charged criminally, so that they realize the consequences of what they are doing. My take is that I just wanted to echo those sentiments that we are really not happy about what is happening. And as for the explanation given by Honorable Kassim regarding Forte, we may never know. We may not say what happened, how the student was done like this and that. We don't know whether that information is true or not. So for me, I don't take it because we don't know what actually happened. Thank you so much.
Sorry, a point of order, Chair. For a member of this committee to accuse another member of lying, I think it's out of order.
No, honourable members, let's not do what we are doing now. Direct it to the Chair and then we deal with whatever the discomfort is about another matter. Honourable Killian, the last honour, let's close it. We've heard what everyone has said.
No, all I wanted to say is I think we must just be very careful when we participate that when we put certain issues before committee, it may be anecdotal evidence until there is a broader sort of detail that emerged. So I think that is the issue and that is why some of the members were concerned. I mean, we do not question the integrity of the member. We are just saying, it's maybe one-sided reporting, so let's get a fuller picture. So I think that is what the honourable members were concerned about. Thank you.
Honourable Suella, you didn't want to come in?
No.
No, okay, all right. Not on the last, on what the DG reported, not on the last part. Okay. Honourable members, I think that's the response that you gave. DJ, I think there's just two things. One is you didn't say anything about, what is this institution's name? Is it Kukuni, I think? You left that out. Unless, the Kukuni one, the Tevet College. And if you could just say something about that one. And then I think members, before the DG responds, I think some of the suggestions that the members have made, some of them obviously, the difficult with some of them is that, Parliament is rising, and what do we do? Order Honourable Kassi, and order, I can see they are still proceeding with the debate over there. And I wanted to suggest that,
I think members made some other suggestions about the police committee. They made suggestions about the range of other things, get more information from the institutions and so on. I think, notwithstanding the fact that we're going into recess, there's probably nothing wrong simply because we are going into, because we are rising, to put some of the police matters, the security matters, through paper and send that to the department and say that we've had a briefing, these were the concerns that have come out, and the committee remain concerned about the range of these things, you know, all these things that we have said. I want to suggest that we don't leave it July and August when we come back, pick it up. Do it now, because the problem is there now, and sending it by writing to them. There's probably nothing wrong to engage with the institutions also, and maybe ask them to put in writing some of the things. That doesn't mean exclude the fact that we shouldn't go to the institutions. The last thing that I wanted to say is, one, we've raised the aspect of dialogue and lines of communications, I think is the word that you use. And maybe, Dj, if you can reflect on that one. Are we making it there or not? And if not, what else is it that we need to do to strengthen the fact that people have simply got to be assisted to talk? We must talk and we must talk. Our first resort is not to take a match and then think things can be solved in that manner. And what else are in the institutions to assist that process? Or is something that is, you know, it's not going to happen anymore. If that's the case, then it's a sad day. Did you?
Just on one or two issues first before DJ comes in, particularly on the issue of Forte. Minister Nwesi is acting Minister for Higher Education and Training. I was with him at Forte the days leading towards the centenary celebrations on Friday 20th. And Minister met with the management of the university, met with the students, issued a media statement afterwards, actually addressed the media afterwards. And so the issues that are being raised here in this summary, actually this is a summary, ma'am, there were a set of 16 demands that were delivered to the management. And so what is reflected here is just the summary and not, so we've got the memorandum that the students delivered, and if needed, we could have summarized all those 16 issues, which we thought is not necessary here.
I think the question was, what are being done about it?
Well, ma'am, this is where I was in. The minister met with the management, met with the students, and then address the media afterwards. There was a question on the students, whether there are any arrests and so on. Yes, there were arrests, not only at Forte, but in this case, yes, there were arrests at Forte. And it is true that also the communities were demonstrating, but that would be outside of our realm in the higher education. The last point I just want to make is that long before this protest, Minister had decided, Minister Zumande had decided to meet with all the SRC. We are in the process of arranging several meetings that Minister will be meeting with the SRC. Perhaps that's the part of the response on the debate. It's not just the SRC presidents, as the Minister had done in January, SRC president and the Secretary General. This time around is going to be all the SRC, all members of the SRC for each and every institution, at least higher education at a start, and then we will also do Tibet at a later stage. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chair. There are roughly four questions that have been asked by the honorable members. Now, in respect to the closing of some campuses, it's normally not the first response by the management as well as endorsement by councils of the institutions to close any campus. It's normally when the assessment in respect to the security risk of staff, students themselves, as well as the property of the institution has actually undertaken. And then a conclusion becomes that it would be in the interest of everybody, including saving lives, loss of lives, in those areas where there is threatening of life from amongst all constituents, that it would be in the best interest of everybody in the institution to have a temporary closure of the institution until certain measures are put in place. So it's not a matter that institutions, us in the department, we take quite lightly, but institutions liable in ensuring that safety of everybody comes first, and everything has to be done in ensuring that does happen. Now, the institutions, together with engagement with the department, there are measures in place in research how then the institution plans to catch up on the lost time. And we've done that in respect to the Invest of Northwest when the laboratory was gutted down, and the assessing the volatility of the situation, which was totally unconducive for anybody to be subjected to it at that moment. So the institution could not have left operational under those circumstances. And also it is a VUD with all considerations. But it's a matter to the best of our ability, and the ability of the institutions is under control, and measures are put in place to plan to catch up on the lost time. The WIFA issues, we are investigating this together with institutions as well as colleges, because it's for the entire school education and training colleges. So the department is working quite hard on this. There are some areas of progress already in respect to this, because not all areas of the country are affected, but there are others that are affected the most. So that's the work that we're currently doing at the present moment. Now, honorable members would recall that government made available about 2.5 billion to address historical debt in our institutions from 2013 to 2015, covering students for about 71,753. And in the main, Forte is amongst the institutions that are affected the most by the historical debt. And it got bit of a lion's share from that fund. So when this happened, I personally interacted immediately with the management of the institution to determine as to what is actually happening, as well as with both the chair and the CEO of NSFAS in respect to NSFAS related matters. The account I got from the management of the institution was that here in this category, it's about 7,000 students who are affected. No, about 8,000, of which 7,000 and some odd, all the issues have been addressed. It's only about 158 that are outstanding, of which we are looking at finalizing this by the close of business. I've got no doubt, then, no basis to doubt the account that the management is giving to me in respect to these issues. But of course, in respect to the question of Forte, there were other issues as well. I don't want to get into, it's not my mandate to get into those. But in respect to the administrative issues, insofar as funding and student debt is concerned, that is what we have done in the department. Out of 2.5 billion, Forte is getting a lion's share, and that money is at their disposal. Now, in terms of administering the disbursement of this money, this is the account they have given, and NSFAS has confirmed that from that side, they have cleared everything which is due to the institution. And after the centenary, I didn't have anything of the seven, you know, as yet. And these students that the university is talking about in actual fact is saying that they had not signed the NSFAS forms, which they must before they are given money, because the institution can't just go around and give this money to students. There are certain compliance matters that have to be undertaken. As to why, I really don't know. And I wish they have signed by now those forms, because they must. Then a certain issue, in respect to the bigger picture of the institution, we have undertaken a detailed analysis of financial situation of FORTE in respect to student housing, forms of leases that the institution has entered into, financial management matters. And after we have undertaken that analysis, the minister has communicated, based on the legislation, to the institution with the form of directive to the specific areas that the institution has to address and give report to the minister. And it's given a fair amount of time to do that. So the council of the investor of FORTE is faced with that process at the present moment. They didn't come back to the minister as yet, but certainly they will come within the processes, the due processes of the law. Now, in respect to legitimate or non-legitimate, we have categorized the issues that students are raising across all institutions, and all the legitimate issues are actually receiving attention, and there is funding, as I have indicated, their own in respect to all those areas, including with a communique that we sent to the institution in respect to the students who are not first beneficiaries as to how their affairs should actually be managed. We can talk about some areas of deficiencies at institutional level and what are we doing in addressing those threats. Now, the question of the minister. I think the minister is hands-on and is always out there in addressing these issues. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been these interventions that we are talking about, including engaging in the processes of each and every institution which is actually affected, as Mr. Mabizela has demonstrated in respect to FORTE. The minister is from there himself in person. But the mode of operation of the minister is not that when there are issues in a particular institution, he would send out in platform to demonize everybody in an institution and the institution itself. We think it would not be proper for a minister to do so. What we normally do, we work out as to how can we assist the institution to get out of the challenges that are confronting it. If there are certain appropriate actions that have to be taken, we take those quite responsibly. Because, you know, the institution is not just about management. We'll be having thousands of students who are there. And whilst we are addressing all these issues also, you must uphold and preserve the credibility of the institution itself, because the implications are too huge for students themselves and for the integrity of the institution itself, which, if handled irresponsibly, would have dire consequences for everybody in the institution. Members would be aware that in the country at the present moment, we are faced with the challenge of aging cohort of academics. And the minister has been working domestically as well internationally with respect to accelerating the training of our students, especially at post-grad level, in order to address this critical challenge which is facing the country is at use at the present moment with some vice chancellors and respective academics in order to address the question of funding strategic partnerships with our institutions, both at undergraduate level activities insofar as the transformation of the curriculum, as well as adequate funding, collaboration and funding, as well as for postgrad in respect for us to be able to get substantial support financially in order to train at postgrad level, because we need these postgrad students to come back and reinforce the system. So it's a well thought initiative, and is to the benefit of the country, because planning can't just be short term. It should be short term, medium term, as well as long term. So there are those activities that you are engaged in at the present moment. Rose University, granted, in all these institutions, there is an element of outsiders who are helping into disrupting the activities of our institutions. Now, that is not our area, but all what we have done as a department, we are meeting with SAP at regular intervals at a national level, engaged on issues and what cooperation, roles and responsibilities amongst us in relation to giving assistance to the post-school education and training system as a whole, as well as specific areas that affect institutions. Unfortunately, we have never been trained, you know, in policy. It's the way that they would do better. What we do, we impress upon a need for policy in a particular institution in respect to a particular development at a given point in time. Well, how they do that, it's not a matter that we have competence to actually really pronounce ourselves, but all what we know is that they have to do that within the imperative of the Constitution as well as legislation. And some institutions would complement that by their private security where it is necessary. Yes, we are having standing engagements with SAPS in respect to all these areas. So the question of access to our institutions is a matter that they control. We give support and assistance the best we can. Well, what the Professor Habib, you know, pointed out, I think it's better placed to elaborate on what he said and what informs that. I don't think I would be in a position to make any comment in respect to that particular matter, because I'm not aware of his specific experience with regard to that matter. Yes, there are criminal actions that are being followed by institutions for everybody who has conducted himself or herself criminally in all these processes. The damages, taxpayers were paying for the damages. What form? We engage with institutions, but the bottom line is that taxpayers have to cough up every time there is damage. There is no other way. It's coming from the public purse. They pay. Whether that money has been transferred to the institution as part of their allocation, or there are other resources that have to be found within that in order to address those. But in a nutshell, it's taxpayers who are paying for all these damages. That's why it is quite important that everybody must hold hands in condemning this act of criminality at the best we can. We are comforted by the comments that the honorable members are making in this regard. With respect to the question of dialogues in institutions, that we encourage and we assist, and we also become part of some of the meetings that are conducted. And I must say, the institutions are doing their level best to engage with all constituencies in this. But as we have indicated, our analysis tells us that there are fringe elements who are not interested in any dialogue, who just place demands on institutions, and the best they are able to, they just impose their will, violence on everybody else, including undermining the processes of SRCs in these institutions. That has been that feature that has been quite prevalent recently. But I think there is a lot of work that has been done to try to arrest that situation, because these three elements are getting isolated day by day. If I look at TVET College, and the problem there is unavailability of water. So there are interim interventions from the side of the department in collaboration with the college of buying more tanks, getting water delivered, and renting additional ablution facilities in order to mitigate the challenge. I've already interacted with the Department of Water and Sanitation, and I'm told that there's a team which is working in that area for the best pipe, and also the Minister, Nomvula Mokonyane, has committed that they will do their level best in ensuring that the matter is being attended to. So I'll be getting feedback, progress report in respect to what concretely are they contributing in that situation. But what we all what we can as a department to address. We were there on the 19th from morning till sunset in working out mechanisms. There are teams that are working on each area of challenge, and there are strict timelines that were put in place for those outstanding matters or problematic areas to be addressed, including getting some funds to relieve the immediate pressures at the college. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, DG. I know there will be many follow-ups, but I want to ask that we actually step off the point now, and that don't protest, honourable member. I want to ask that we step off this point because we've got two bigger reports that we have to deal with also. One on the quarterly report, and then of course the CETA matter. I know I saw your body language during the response that there are some issues that you are unhappy with. But
it was mentioned that they're not onto their board, so we can find it shock at those members to even highlight those. Even if you don't have far questions or new questions, but there's something that's just unanswered on the board and you have to make part without being asked to even the questions that you are.
Switch on the mic. I didn't hear what you said.
So I'm saying that there was a question, for example, that was not answered at all. Okay. So if you don't want to allow follow-up questions or any new questions, whatever the case may be, at least allow us to highlight the questions that were not answered so that those questions that we have already asked can be answered.
I was going to come to that honorable member, but you were intimidating me so much with your body language there. I wasn't scared, but nevertheless, I was going to find out that all the questions were answered. And what are the questions that were not answered?
Thank you, Jefferson. I specifically asked the question as to say that there were two questions that weren't answered in particular. It was spoken around, but the one wasn't answered at all. I specifically asked the question, and Honorable Bazoli asked the same question as well. And we have every right to ask this question because we have oversight over the executive. Now, I must say this because our members have tried to say we can't ask certain questions. Where is the minister? And is he in Monrovia? If not, where is he and what is he doing there during this crucial period? We're not saying massively or whatever. We just are asking a question about our minister that we have oversight over. And it's a relevant question. The second question is, that was not answered,
is why at the University of Port Clair, until May, students have been prevented, not that students didn't want to, students have been prevented from signing loan agreements. Not students didn't want to go sign loan agreements, the students were called to sign and didn't sign. Why were they prevented? They were never given the opportunity and were never allowed to sign their loan agreements.
Vinci, I heard you answering the issue about the minister. And I also heard you answering the issue about the you spoke about networks and you spoke about the fact that monies were made available and so on. So I'm not sure which part is it that you did not answer. There's a difference between if your answer is not satisfactory. There's a difference between that and... But can you get back to that?
Thank you very much. The minister is approached and they have explained the purpose of him being approached. Right. The second thing, I don't know who is preventing students to sign the next fast forms, but what I know about out of 8,000 and some odd students, 158 students haven't signed the next fast forms. Why are they not signing? I don't know. If there is anybody who is preventing them, I can find out that. But as far as I know, the institution gave an undertaking that they would ensure that by the end of business on the 17th of May, those forms are signed. As to whether they are signed now or not, I don't have that feedback. It's a matter that we follow up. Who's preventing them, I really don't know.
The hands that were up, are you done now? Honorable Kisana, Honorable.
Chair, I just want to say on the minister. When the minister is actually not secret, because this morning SAFM, he spoke, I mean it is already public knowledge, he spoke between 7 and 8 changes in the state, and there are a group of universities there that will have a relationship with our university here in order to exchange resources. Student exchange, especially postgrad students from South Africa, in order to address the thing of closing the gap of the aging academics in South Africa, that we need to produce young PhDs. So she spoke actually at length about this group of universities in America that are going to have a pact of some sort, the relation with South African universities in order to exchange needed resources. So I'm just saying it is public knowledge, it is there, and I'm surprised that, you know, it comes up that he's where he is, he's doing something, set up his young, so I'm just saying he was discussing it openly on radio, as any of them this morning.
I just want to say that it is really very inappropriate for Honourable Kassim to try to hop the chair, to throw the questions, and to then be dissatisfied. What we usually do is in all committees, once there has been a reply to the questions, and some questions maybe have fallen off, we're not adequately replied to, two ways. To say, can the department please reply on the following, X, Y, and Z, or alternatively submit the question as a written question to the department. We also have had the experience, Honourable Chair, and you are a new chair to this committee, that the Honourable Kassim tries to hog the microphone, and then the rest of the agenda cannot be dealt with, and then halfway through the rest of the agenda he picks up his bags and he leaves. So that's not appropriate. So I really want to object very vehemently.
Chair, point of order. The Honourable Kassim is receiving now, and it's unnecessary.
No,
it is very unnecessary. I've never left in the middle of a meeting after
something. When you say a point of order again, let me... now is the opposite. Don't just speak one time. Finish with Honourable Kenya.
So, Chairperson, all I'm saying is we really have the rest of the agenda, which are very important items. We've dealt with this matter. We believe we can have a regular interaction. Honourable Zerli has asked for further information and regular updates. That's perfectly in order. But
please, we cannot allow a member to intimidate the rest of the committee every time that we meet as a committee of higher education. Thank you, Jane.
I want to really ask the members, with your permission, can we go to the next point?
Yes.
Because that point is equally important to the first point. Director General, are you leading us on that point?
Yeah. Thanks. The presentation on the second and third quarter performance report of 2015-2016. I think this is more of a catch-up.
Going for it, Chairperson.
What is the point of order?
Chair, my point is with regards to the specific agenda point. Now, you were not previously chairing this committee, but the performance report of the department. There is a standing resolution of this committee. And I've informed the secretary about this, so it's not the first time I'm raising it. I've informed the secretary earlier on that there's a standing resolution of this committee. You'll find in the minutes of this committee that whenever the department is doing quarterly reports, either the minister or deputy minister must be present. Now, I understand if the minister is abroad, I don't know where the deputy minister is, but that is a resolution of the committee, and it should then be scheduled even if that resolution is not going to be implemented. It is the resolution of the committee.
Director General, proceed with yourself.
Thank you very much, Chair. If I may, that's straight to the background, because I'm mindful of the fact. For the 2015-16 financial year, the annual performance plan had 33 performance indicators encompassing 61 targets, which are direct outputs of the department. The APP as well also had 30-16 performance targets, which were monitored and reported by the core delivery programs of the department. For the two quarters under review, the department had 27 targets, of which 18 of those targets, which is 7%, were achieved, as planned, and 9, which is 33%, were not achieved. 5 of the targets that were not achieved within the time frame were subsequently achieved. So the slides that follow will present further details of the targets. As mentioned, for the two quarters, of which then what would be outstanding is the quarter four of the same financial year. And at the same time, we are working on the processes of the annual report, of which we would also like to get guidance from the portfolio committee as well. That fourth quarter would have to present as a standalone, or it could be presented together with the annual report, taking into consideration there is a kind of coincidental overlap at the present moment. But I'll ask Mr. Mkiba to take us through the program quickly.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Program 2. Chairperson, which is the Human Resource Development Planning and Monitoring Coordination, had for the 2016 financial year 9 targets, but in respect to the two quarters under review, there were 2 targets, 1 in each. In respect to the targets in the second quarter, which was to produce iWill, which is a registration system for learners seeking work-integrated learning opportunities and firms wanting to provide work integration. This target was achieved as planned. The other target, which was in the third quarter, was gazette and approved policy and guidelines on recognition of prior learning. This was not achieved as planned. However, the policy was subsequently achieved following the approval by the minister, and it was gazetted in March. Chair, in respect to Program 3, which is university education, its purpose there is to develop and coordinate policy and regulatory frameworks for effective and efficient university education system And it also provides financial support to universities, NASFAS, and the National Institute for Higher Education. For the 2015-16 financial year, the program has plans to deliver 20 targets, and this is a program also that monitors the performance of the system, the universities in particular, against 17 delivery targets. For the two quarters under review, there were 7 targets, 4 in quarter 2 and 3 in quarter 3. The 4 targets in quarter 2, the program managed to achieve 2, namely policy on the minimum norms and standards for student housing at public universities, which was published in a gazette on the 29th of September 2015. The other deliverable there is the report on the effective use of the foundation provision grant for 23 universities, which was approved by the Director General on the 4th of September 2015. Chairperson, the other two targets that could not be achieved as planned are as follows. A report on the analysis of a university annual report in terms of the financial indicators, revised regulations on private higher education institutions. But I must say that these two targets were subsequently achieved, Mr. President. In terms of the third quarter, there were 3 targets, and all of the targets were achieved as follows. A report on the effective use of the 2014-15 Teaching Development Grant. Evaluation report on effective use of the Research Development Grant in 2014-2015. As well as the Student Leadership Capacity Development Strategy and Program, which was approved for implementation by October 2015. In respect to the performance of the system and the universities in particular, there were about 17 targets during 2014 academic year. And during the third quarter, the program reported as follows. 10 of the 17 were achieved. And among the achieved targets, you will notice that most of those were actually overachieved. And talking here of graduates in engineering sciences, whose target was 10,100, the achievement is 12,058. Graduates in natural and physical sciences, 6,600 was the target. The achievement 7,295. Graduates in teaching education from universities, 17,500 was a target, 19,124 was a target, although was an achievement. In respect to doctoral graduates from universities, there's overachievement there by 408. In respect to research master's graduates, there's also an overachievement of about 1,029. The throughput rate there was achieved as planned, 35%. The number of universities offering accreditative and college qualification also achieved as planned at 3. And in terms of success rate, we're sitting at 77% against the planned 76%. The undergraduate success rate in terms of contact, we're sitting at 22% from a target of 80%. Percentage of university academic staff with PhDs, we're sitting at 43%, against a target of 42%. This is the performance in respect of the 2014 academic year, and this information was verified in October 2015. However, Chair, there were areas that were not achieved within the system, particularly in research for student enrollment in public higher education studies at universities. The target was 1,100,000. There's an underachievement there of about 30,946. In terms of graduates in human health and animal health from universities, there's also an underperformance there of about 18. The undergraduate success rate in terms of distance education, there is an underperformance there of about 3%. In terms of the number of additional first-time entrants, black and women to academic workforce in addition to normal replacement plans, there is an underperformance of about one. The plan target there was 100, the system achieved 99. Number of first-time student information programs, there's also an achievement of about 4,690. In terms of the number of eligible students obtaining financial aid, there's also an achievement there of about 18,850. The last target that was not achieved, Chairperson, is the proportion of universities meeting standards of good governance. And this target actually was not monitored. So during the financial year, the intention was to come up with governance standards that would have been agreed before the department monitor. In terms of program four, Chairperson, which is DSET, there were about 8 targets in total for the 15-16 financial year. And sports program also is a program that monitors the performance of the system in respect to TVET colleges. There were 10 targets in that respect. But for the quarter under review, there were 7 targets, 4 in quarter 2 and 3 in quarter 3. The 4 targets in quarter 2, only three were achieved, which is the annual teaching and learning support plan for the research system, the monitoring and evaluation report for the research institution, as well as the strategy on strategic partnerships with key stakeholders, which was approved by the Director General on the 14th of September 2016. The target that could not be achieved is the conduct policy for NASCAR. But this policy was subsequently achieved by the approved by the minister on the 30th of March 2016. One of the 3 targets in the third quarter was achieved, namely policy directives for TVET College Information Technology Systems. The 2 targets that could not be achieved are as follows: the guidelines for standardized implementation of occupational programs, which was also subsequently achieved, the building of the 6 TVET College campuses. So we had a target of 6, but in terms of this report, only 3 of the 6 colleges were actually built, but the level of completion is sitting currently at 50% of the two campuses that were built, and one of which is sitting at 99%. The other 3 colleges couldn't be achieved, and the building of those has not started as yet due to supply chain processes. In terms of program 5, which is the skills development, the targets for the financial year is 15, and the program also monitors the system and CTAS in particular, and therein there are about 4 delivery targets. For the quarter under review, there were 11 targets, 5 in quarter 2 and 6 in quarter 3. 4 of the 5 targets in quarter 2 were achieved, namely the CTAS monitoring report in respect to the skills development strategy implementation, as well as the artisan development, whose target was 5,000, but 7,526 new artisans were ever registered. 4,773 new artisans were qualified, exceeding the target by 1,773. Lastly, the National Artisan Learners Trade Test at Indela, which was 2% above the planned 50%. The one target that was not achieved in the second quarter is the average lead time from trade test application received until trade test concluded. The planned target there was 170 days. the 70 days more than targeted. So it took more than 100 days to actually process the applications received at Indes. Four of the six targets in the third quarter were achieved as follows. Sika monitoring report, the registration of new artisan learners, which surpassed the target of 5,000 and 1,254, as well as the new targets qualified, which also exceeded the target of 3,000 by 182. The National Artisan Learner Trade Test pass rate was also surpassed by about 4% from the target of 50%. The two targets, two targets were not achieved in the third quarter as follows: workplace-based learning policy. This policy is currently a draft. It was approved by the minister, but for further consultation with cabinet. So until the consultation process is finalized, the policy will be treated as a draft, hence it's recorded as has not achieved. The average lead time from trade test application received until trade test conducted continues to be under performance. This time around in terms of quarter three, it's 57 days more than targeted, which remains a problematic area. Now, in terms of non-financial information, Chairperson, this is where the department is standing in terms of the second and third quarter. I will then hand over to the CEO to take us through the finance part of the presentation. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members. In terms of the second quarter, the total spending by the end of the second quarter was 65.4% of the total budget after 6 months, while after the first quarter it was just below 40%. This high spending rate, obviously one would have expected after 6 months that spending would only be 50%, but we have approval from National Treasury to do uneven transfers to universities as well as the TVET colleges and NSFAS, in order to ensure that we address the issues around academic years. The average spending for operational activities at that stage, if we include compensation of employees, was 44%, and compensation of employees were in total 44.3%. Now, there are two main components under compensation of employees. First of all, just the normal personnel expenditure, where the percentage was at 43.4%. Was a bit low at that stage, mainly because of the function shift, and that by the end of the second quarter, all the expenditure related, especially to the Eastern Cape Provincial Department, did not already kick into the system on the side of the department. There was a late transfer on the system from the side of that province, and therefore all the expenditure did not yet reflect it. There were also funded vacancies for support functions, and there are TVET and CET functions, and those were still in process of being filled. In terms of examiners and moderators, which is the second big portion of compensation of employees, spending already stood at 120.6%. It is every year a high-risk item, and it is influenced by the exam cycle. So by the end of the second quarter, we already anticipated quite a larger overspending on that specific item due to the examinations of November and the supplementary exams that would still come in the last quarter. This item and the increase thereon is mainly influenced by the increased number of enrollments in TVET colleges. The next two slides, Chair, is giving you the exact details of the information provided on slide 15. I'm not going to go through that in detail. So slide 16 and 17, we can skip them. On slide 18, there's a summary of the status at the end of the third quarter, end of December, when the overall spending was by then 82.5%. And if you look at the spending rate for the second quarter, as I indicated, was 65.4%, you can see the increase there. Average spending for normal operational activities, 69.3%. And if we look at compensation of employees, that was also 69.3% at that stage. The personnel expenditure specifically 68.4%, and that was slightly lower than we expected if we look at the trend for the year. But as I indicated previously, there were still certain links from personnel that had to kick in into the expenditure of the department. For examiners and moderators, a very small increase by the end of the third quarter, mainly because most of the claims for the November exam only arrived at the department during the period January and February, so very little claims were processed during the third quarter, and therefore a very low increase in that specific expense item. There's slide number 19 and slide number 20 once again, just gives you the exact numbers for that period. And if you can look at slide number 21 as the last one for the summary, as of 31 December, by that stage, all the transfer payments to our institutions were completed and they were on schedule. The only outstanding transfers were those linked to specific claims for ad hoc subsidies. There were problems experienced with PASOL, as I indicated, regarding the interfaces from various PEDs, provincial education departments. There were incorrect link codes in some cases, and you would also note that if you look back at the expenditure per program, that program 5 shows an overspending during the second and third quarter. That was due to some of these incorrect link codes, and at that stage there was a process ongoing to correct. We can confirm that by the end of the fourth quarter, all those areas were corrected. Expenditure trends will continue to be monitored closely, and we implemented all the cost-saving measures effectively. We did not foresee at that stage any overspending of the boat for the 2015-16 financial year. I can confirm also now that we did not overspend the boat and there were no unauthorized spending. There were limited underspending projected on our normal operation activities, goods and services, but we did by that time already foresee that there would be a larger underspending under compensation of employees, mainly as a result of the function shift. All spending are monitored carefully to ensure that there is no overspending and that we keep our underspending also to a minimum. Thank you, Chairperson. That's the summary by me.
Did you anything else?
No, we're done, sir, with the presentation.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. Number 1, Janice Athene, and then number 2, Killian, number 3, Suela, number 4, and member numbers, and Honourable Kigana, Honourable Kune, those are the answers I see.
Thank you, Chair. First point, there are two interesting reports that you've mentioned that both seem to be uncompleted, or maybe they're completed, I don't think. The one is a report on university annual reports to assess viability, financial viability of university. Can we see that report, and now is that going to be an annual thing, and will it be submitted annually to the committee? Then another one is a report on governance standards. Are universities adhering to governance standards? Can we also see that report and regularly look at it? Then my second point is the unachieved TVET. I mean, this is becoming a bit of a joke. You know, for 2 years now, the President has put in his annual presidential statement how wonderfully TVETs are going to be built. We're going to have 6 TVETs, blah, blah, blah. Well, we now have a stage where only one of them is 99% completed. 2 of them are 50%, and the other 3 aren't even started. Can we have a report on what's going on there? I mean, this is really shocking. You've mentioned supply chain management in every case, but this, I think it's 2 years or 3 years now since this has been planned, and nothing seems to be happening. First point, now I'm looking at the CETA, the construction CETA, and I see that under that CETA there are no fewer than 54,000 students at any one time being funded. And yet the time, and that's for various things, short courses, you know, getting RPL and learnerships and artisanship. Now, in your targets, the only thing that the department has a target about, and then they have a minor target about learnerships, which is how long, no, I can't remember what the target is, but they have a minor target around learnership. Where is the department's target about all the other people who are registered in CETAs? There must be hundreds of thousands of them. If there are 54,000 in one CETA, there must be 200 or 300,000 other people registered in CETAs. And the department has no targets in relation to us. So I just wondered where those targets are, because I think when it comes to target setting in the new term, you will need to convince us that you actually have targets, that you take responsibility for those students. And my last point is CET. It looks as though the functional shift for that is going slower than you predicted. I do know that anecdotally I have had emails from people who used to work for provinces and who now say they're not getting paid, they don't have jobs, they don't know what's happening to them. So I'm just very concerned about the non-achievement of that, and wonder if you could assure us that that is now going to be brought to conclusion. Thank you.
Jay, I would first just like to ask a question about slide 16. Just the percentage spent. What is quite significant is that skills development has been 234.4%. It is sort of it is quite high compared to the other things. Is there any explanation for that? Could you perhaps just understand what the reason for that is? Secondly, because personnel expenditure is going to probably be, well, yes, the annual sort of budget has now been concluded, it's run out, fourth term is all over, etc. So there is no further risk with, I take it that there is no further risk with examiners over expenditure that we've seen, because we know that that is high risk area, but because the personnel expenditure has come in lower, that's probably they're probably able to balance the books as far as that is concerned. Could we just get a comment on that? Then lastly, if we look at the issue of the TVET College Builds Program, does the department make provision in the current, in the past financial year for specific capital expenditure? And if so, will there be a rollover to the next financial year so that we, whatever was in the pipeline and due to issues such as supply chain management problems, could not be fulfilled. Only three of the six TV colleges was in fact commenced with. Will there be a rollover if money for capital expenditure was in fact in the pipeline? If the department could please respond to that. Thank you. Can I just ask one last one? That is the governance standards for universities. Do we have that in place now? I mean, was that the performance indicator in program 3 was said that it did not achieve it on time, but do we have it in place right now? And that is on page on slide 9. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me just start by welcoming all the reports. I'm having a few questions on program number 3 under the universities. There is a target that was made for 205,000 eligible students through National Skills Financial Scheme. And I think it was also budgeted for, and only 18,850 was achieved. Why was the target not met? When what is the reason for the shortage? On program number 4 on TVET, we previously was reported that there were some challenges with the appointment of contractors. Have the procurement process finalized and contractors appointed? If not yet, what are the challenges around that? Thank you.
Since my question has been answered, you can pass.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question relates to the period markers. Are they ever paid on time? Because I can see here still waiting for claims for November 2015. And in the course of one just happened to meet some of these people complaining that it takes long for them to receive their payment after marking these papers. The second question that I would like to ask is in respect of Program 2, where there was only one target that fortunately was met, but I would like to find out whether the IWIL is operational, and if not, when will it become operational? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. One is concerned, Chair, that the system was not able to achieve the number of students enrolled in public higher education studies by 30,946. This raises serious concerns whether the system will be able to achieve the MTSF target by 2019. If the department can just explain with regards to this issue. On the question that was asked by Honorable Ngadi Main, I wanted to add that why was the target not met and where did the funding for 18,850 students went to? We want to be clarified on that issue. Lastly, Chair, regarding the task. I would like to know which trades and occupations attract more women and which ones are male-dominated, just for interest's sake, and what plans are in place to increase the number of women in scarce skills related to artisan development programs. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I've been largely covered by my colleagues before me. I'll only ask one question, even that one is a follow-up question on the question by Honorable Bosoli and Honorable Killian. It's on TVET colleges. I'm just interested to know, why is it necessary to build new colleges? Because there are so many colleges of education that were shut down. One would expect that these are reopened and, if necessary, re-innovated. Alternatively, it was reported that the community colleges were converted into TVET colleges. So one would expect that we have more than enough of these. So why are we building new ones? Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Those are the questions. The only one is, wherever you're overachieved, where do you get the money from? Over to DJ. You don't get overexcited when you say overexpenditure. That means money.
No, thank you very much, Seth. Yeah, let me... Yeah, I'll ask my colleagues to come in on this session. But let me put into context this question of building 12 new TVET college campuses, not for the country. What we did in the department, we undertook mapping with respect to the location of post-school education and training facilities for the entire country. Universities, TVET colleges, former teacher training colleges. What we came to realize out of that study was that there is a concentration of facilities mainly in urban centers, and as you move away from the urban centers, there is nothing. Then the planning looked at slugging the gaps, because in some areas one would have a distance of about 350 kilometers before you can come across some kind of post-school education and training facilities. So the planning then of building the 12 new Tibet College campuses, looking at plugging those gaps, and we are looking also at the other things beyond that in order to intensify that group. So the former teacher training colleges, one, the others are being utilized currently by the Tibet colleges for teaching and learning, training as well. But others are being utilized by provincial government departments, offices, and the other related activities. So they are not underutilized, they are not unutilized, you know, at the present moment. So I thought it's important to put that in context. We'll get into the detail of the issues. I would ask Faisal to just respond on where are we in respect to the construction of the 12 Tibet College campuses, bearing in mind that they are all located in rural areas, and in some instances there are no bulk services, and yes, and the municipalities don't have the capacity to do so, and in some instances there are land questions, because land you find that is owned by chiefs, and if you don't own the land you can't put a government structure. So there are quite a number. There are quite a number of hurdles that we have overcome on the way towards construction. There are other factors as well. But I give over to Fidel to just take us through.
Thank you, Chair. Just to give you a context in terms of Tibet College campuses, there are 12 new Tibet College campuses that's been passable over 5 years. So currently, what we did was we went on tender for all 12 at the same time. As a result, there were tender issues in terms that could not allocate some of those tenders. So as a result, three of them were allocated. And the pictures will show you an indication, I think you show the first and the second slide, you show an indication of the campus that's currently going to be handed over now at the end of May. So that is the first one that's currently ready for handover. Slides 3 to 6 is basically indications in terms of progress of the other two remaining campuses that we're reporting on currently now. That is the status, and the intention is that they will be completed before the end of this academic year. With regard to the other 9 remaining college campuses, they are currently out of tender. The closing date is roughly the 3rd of June. Tender will close, and if it's awarded over the 5-year period, we will then be able to construct. So there's a slight delay in the construction of the first 3, but the intention is that once it's been awarded within 18 months, it should be completed. And it is campuses, not new colleges. We just need to be clear on that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Gigi. Honourable members, the bullets have been covered. I think there's a specific question on the I will. Yes, it is operational. It was completed on the 10th of September 2015, and at the moment we have 248 students that have registered. We have 6 firms that have registered that they have opportunities for placement, and we've made 17 referrals. I think that is the only question.
On some of the questions that I asked on universities, the annual report which analyzes the financial statements of the universities, yes, that can be made available. to the members, to the honorable members. And by the way, let me just state this, that the annual reports of the institutions, individual institutions, get published, so they are public documents too. Then on the governance standards, the governance standards, as indicated on slide 9, we are developing the standards. The question was asked by both Honorable Bozoli and Honorable Killian. We're developing the standards. Our target and on the APP is that by next year, March, we should be having them. It is only at that point that we will start to measure the institutions on whether they are meeting them or not. And this development of the standards is done with institutions, by the way. The institutions in the annual reports do report generally on the issues of governance, just generally, but without any set targets, that this is the target, this is the indicator, and so on. So that is what now we are developing, to have those indicators. And then there was a question on the target not achieved, again also on slide 9, of the enrollment of students, the target having been 1,100,000, and the achievement being 30,000 less. That's the target, yes, set on the MTLS. The question was whether we will be able to achieve that target. It's difficult, again, to say that we'll be able to, because it's dependent on a number of factors, and that's why it's difficult. The target we have is that of 2030, for us to have 1,600,000 students, and that would take us to participation rate of 25%. Now, leading up to 2030, it's very difficult to say that we are going to be able to meet these targets of 1,000,000 at this point, 1,100,000, and so on and so on, leading up to 2030. And one of the things we should be emphasizing here, the growth in student enrollment is not at the stage in tandem with the growth in facilities and academics. So the load of students' enrollment is becoming heavier and heavier on the academics, because we are not growing on that side of the academics. And the growth also means more money that the state is supposed to be giving to the institutions. But instead, it's the opposite that is happening. We are getting the state funding less and less to the universities. So it's a big issue that needs to be resolved, particularly in this house, in the building, in Parliament. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah. Basically, these governance standards, we are engaging with the institutions, because in some of the systemic gaps that we have identified, discussed with the minister, determined the approach, after which we put it to the attention of the institutions themselves, the forum which is working, because we want to strengthen our capacity and our ability to monitor and detect risk areas quite in time in the institutions. In the main, in responding to the issues that Honorable Kasim raised, you know, earlier on. And it's a matter that we are not imposing to the institutions. So they are raising their concerns, we look at them, we clean up. But I think when this is in operational, it's going to assist into making a determination and monitoring of governance issues as well as operational matters in our institutions across. Because we believe that it's through that engagement that we'll be able to build a sustainable system going forward, rather than just coming and imposing what we think should actually be happening. Because we are not managing, we are not governing. We can only assist into strengthening the system as well as the operations. That's what informs the engagement. So it's one of the things concretely that the minister is doing, having understood the landscape and the operations per institution. And we want something that would cut across institutions, because you don't design systems for a certain category of institutions. You design it for the entire system as a whole. CFO?
Thank you, Chair Sandy G. I think three specific matters to deal with. First of all, the overspending on Program 5. I would like to show ministers, if you look at slide number 16, it does reflect that the Program 5 skills development overspending variance of 148.8 million. If you go to slide number 19, you'll see that the overspending decreased to just over 9 million. So a major difference between the two. And then if you look at slide number 20, the second bullet, or slide 21, sorry, the second bullet, we indicate that there were problems when we received the function shift. So some of the link codes received from provinces were incorrect. So as a result of this automatic process within the PASOL system, some of the expenditure for TVETs and CETs actually were allocated to Program 5. And we were busy with the correction of those, therefore you'll see the substantial decrease by the end of the third quarter in the overspending. Everything was corrected before the close of the financial year, with eventually a small surplus on Program 5. So just to clarify that matter, in terms of the overspending of examiners and moderators and the balancing of the books, functions or funds have been shifted within compensation of employees where examiners and moderators are being paid, and at the end of the financial year there were no problems there. So yes, the books were balanced and there were no overspending reflected. The last one, just Chairperson, very briefly on the exam claims. I must acknowledge that yes, there were delays in the processing of exam claims, mainly because of the volumes that the department had to do with, taking into account that all the claims previously dealt with by provincial education departments also had to be dealt with by the department. All those claims first go to our exam section, where they verify that the claim is correct, it's indeed registered examiner or moderator, and they verify all the information. From there, the claims are submitted to the finance section, where the claim is then finally processed. And during that process, there is also a verification process. For example, is the person actually registered on parcel? If not, the person is first loaded with the examiner moderator before you can pay the claim. So there are a lot of processes, number one, and because of the volumes that they had to deal with, and we're talking thousands, there was a delay in the processing of some of the claims, taking also into account that there were a number of claims that were actually wrong or incorrect, or where bank account numbers were not correct, not in line with what's on the system. We even identified a few claims where the person did not exist or where the ID number is incorrect, and therefore those claims would not be processed. So that is just to give you an indication. Also taking into account that as soon as an exam cycle is completed, for example the November exam, claims only start to come in around the end of December, beginning of January, before the department can even start the verification process and start to process those claims. So there's also always a delay of approximately 6 to 8 weeks after an exam, even before we receive the claims and can start to proceed. Thank you, Dr.
Thanks very much, Chairperson PG. And I must say, questions related to skills programs are quite very stimulating, and I must appreciate that. The first one I must attend to is with regard to targets relating to CETAs. You'll see that in our APP, we do not allude into all areas that we monitor
with regard to CTAS. If I can mention, there are about 25 indicators that we enter into in terms of the service level agreement between the department and the CTAS. It is in various areas. And those areas, of course, are informed by the National Skills Development Strategy 3, which is implemented by CTAS. So there is a whole range of areas of variables in that area. So if we're to be allowed to have all those areas that should be, where we have an APP only for the skills program. So that is why, therefore, we tend to elicit those other key areas, noting, of course, that we are also involved in monitoring a variety of other areas as dictated by the Skills Development Act. Also, this interesting question with regard to women or female participating into trades, artisan trades in particular. I must say it's also interesting when I was looking into figures that we're having more numbers of women in the area of manufacturing, which is under a MERCETA. And we're happy when we have more women in this area because the manufacturing is an area that is key to the development of the economy or growing of the economy, as also enunciated in the National Development Plan, Industrial Policy Action Plan, as well as the New Growth Plan. So we are quite very happy that there is a large number of women participating in those areas. Whereas also to kite also in MUA sector, meaning with the mining sector, we have more women in artisan trades in the mining sector, and also in the transport sector, which is under TITA, that is the CETA, as well as under EWC, that is Energy and Water CETA. If we look into a case that we normally refer to as trades that are in demand in the country, is electrician, is boiler maker, is plumber, is speaker, is welder, is diesel mechanic, is motor mechanic, is rigging, is refrigerator mechanic and bricklaying. So those are the ones we normally refer to them as top 10 trades that are in demand in the country. There is a question as well around what is that we are doing as a department to encourage in particular women or young women to participate in this trade. Committee members will be averse to the fact that we have been reporting about certain programs that as the department were running. In 2013, we declared the whole 2013 as the year of artisan, whereby Deputy Minister in particular was assigned with the responsibility of going around with regard to career development around the area of trades, whereupon we're saying the school to an artisan, we need to encourage especially young people, women, to venture into this area. Not that it's not cool to be wearing a suit and sitting in an office, but then these are the areas that are so demanded by the economy if we are to grow the economy at the level that is so required by the NDP at 1%, as well as the new growth path that will be between 4 to 7% per annum. In 2014, of course, May from 2013, we declared a decade of artisan. That's 2014 up until 2024, meaning which therefore the department is paying a particular attention around artisan development in the country. Once again, it's an area that is led by the Deputy Minister, targeting employers, because we all know that if you are an artisan, the master employer, of course, who is going to offer an apprenticeship. Meeting also learners, meeting colleges, as well as other important stakeholders in this area. Committee members also will be versatile or conversant with the fact that the NGP has placed a target of 30,000 artisans to be produced by the country by 2030. We are working very hard with regard to that particular area, hence we have declared 2014-2024 as the decade of artisans. So the call goes to everybody to say, you must partner with the department with regard to this very important area of artisan development in the country. You'll also be aware that within the department we have embedded career development services. Annually, we are hosted by various provinces, where we go around And one of the areas that we so emphasize is the area of artisan development.
I see there is a lot of interference from my colleagues.
And that is in switching off the mic. But then, thanks very much with this honor, Chairperson and honorable members.
I must assure you that you are protected.
We must thank you for this.
With regard to Honorable Chair and members, with regard to community colleges, I just would like to make sure that the members are comforted that this is a reconstruction and development project. We are trying to create something out of nothing. Secondly, part of the reason why the days it might have mentioned in this report is because basically most of the indicators are in the 16-17 report. And that's where you will have to hold us accountable in terms of performance of the sector. But the project is to rationalize that which was not to something that we can be able to say that is a community education and training college. Thank you very much.
I think one outstanding question is the infrastructure rollover. Close?
No, thank you, DG. On the question of infrastructure rollover, this is a grant funding. The funds are already ring fenced.
National Skill Fund, we are building these 12 new TVET college campuses and the refurbishment of the four from National Skills Fund. Yeah.
Thank you much. Members, your question has been answered? Yes? Yes?
I don't know if you wanted to just make the comment, but some of us started saying, you know, just asking questions. But I think we need to commend the department for what they have achieved. We all know the budgetary constraints. We all know the efforts that they've gone through to advance very important motivations why we should see a higher percentage of our GDP allocated to this budget vote. But within the limited fund at their disposal, it is quite remarkable how they have set the targets realistically to the extent that they could achieve most of them, if not on the towards the end of their third term, then at least they were able to achieve that and within budget, not overspending it. So I think they should get credit for it, and we should really commend them for that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Your question hasn't been answered.
Comment?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. No, it was with regard to Honorable Guzman's question. I think it was very important, but at the same time, I would like to commend the department for conducting audits and ensuring that the former teacher education colleges are efficiently used. That one, we are very happy about it. They are either the TVETs or training centers. We are really happy about it.
Okay, as we are about to step off the point, DG and the officials, the Valo that was so passionate about what he was presenting, and you shouldn't do that to cut him off like that. He was on a roll there, and you something. One comment that you make, which I think we obviously cannot associate ourselves with, and that is, it's not right to say that there are lots of women in manufacturing, and we may, because it's a little bit on the patriarchal side to think that women should have skills only in manufacturing and not elsewhere, and I think we should maybe not associate ourselves that that should be the trend that we have. We need women in very many different skills in our economy. So, because that's the historical one, that women were just relegated to those kind of sectors. So, I think you need to make a bit of a change there. Honorable Cassie.
Chair, this is a point of order. I have raised this at the beginning of this discussion, and you have noted that I did not participate in this last session. Chairperson, the point of order is that yourself, as a chairperson, has broken a resolution of the committee. I have just pulled up the minutes of the 5th of August 2015, and I'll quote from these minutes. It was proposed and adopted that the political authority, minister and deputy minister, should be present whenever the department's performance is under scrutiny. This is from the minister adopted, the minutes of the 5th of August 2015. Essentially, this is a resolution of committee that has been broken, Chairperson. I raised this with you. You have ignored that point that I raised previously. I wanted notice for the minutes of this meeting that I have raised this point and that we will be taking further action in this class.
I just want to make the following point. There seems to be a complete misunderstanding of, first of all, the Constitution, the separation of powers in the Constitution, where you have an executive authority and a legislative authority, and the legislative authority with the responsibility and obligation to oversee executive action, not to dictate to the minister where he should go and where he shouldn't go, firstly. Secondly, which of the committee meets he is compelled to attend. Clearly, we can invite the minister or his deputy to participate in meetings, and we are free to have him. We all know that this committee meets on Wednesdays when usually it is cabinet days. So we cannot adopt a resolution compelling the minister to be present when the reports are presented. We can inquire about it and we can engage with him. There are many mechanisms in the National Assembly rules that you can engage with the minister, pose questions. You can have member statements. All of that exists. But it does not mean that the minister has now broken a resolution of this committee, or that you, in your capacity as chairperson, have not abided by a resolution. This committee has no such authority to take compelling resolutions, and therefore I want to ask you to please discard whatever the Honourable Catherine has said. There is a complete misunderstanding in the ranks of the Democratic Alliance about how Parliament and how the executive functions. I believe it's the same as the city council. It is not. In city councils, you have the executive members and the other members sitting in the same body. It does not mean that that is true for national parliament and for provincial legislatures. Please, I really want to ask you to describe that. If Honourable Casson wants to demonstrate to us a moral parliament, why don't they start in the Western Cape provincial legislature? Thank you, Chairman.
I think this debate is now going into another direction. And how can you assist us to get to a solution here?
Chairperson, I just wanted to indicate that at the beginning there were apologies that were presented and accepted, and at the same time there has been an agenda that we have adopted that we should follow. So what Honourable Kassim is raising now, which for me is issue, because it should have raised at the beginning when adopting the agenda anyway. Sure.
Last word on this one. Chair, the fact of the matter remains that witness Killian present, and all the members here present,
this resolution was passed by our person last year, and I have a copy in front of me. It was passed because it was an occasion where we were having very important discussion about the department's performance. And while we were having the discussion, the minister, the deputy minister, and the DG were sitting outside having a press conference. And the committee was very outraged at that, because there was no reason why they couldn't have scheduled the press conference after the committee had discussed the department's performance. So I think the spirit of the resolution was one in which you were saying, we want the minister's answerability to this committee to be made concrete when it is a departmental issue. And everybody agreed with that. It seemed perfectly sensible. So I'm not sure why there's this unconstitutional outrage being expressed and weird accusations made about the DA as opposed to... this was a committee decision supported by the chair, supported by all members. So I think this has now been blown out of proportion. I think we would like to see the minister here when the department's own performance is being discussed. Fine, if it has to be by invitation, but really we need to put a bit of pressure on the minister, because he doesn't often come. He often doesn't come to Parliament either, so this idea that we have lots of opportunities to engage with him is not entirely true. And I would like to appeal to you to maybe we could pause discussion now and you could go back and contemplate those minutes
and maybe come back with some sort of guidance at our next meeting. It's too late now to do anything about this.
Okay, Ghana?
No, Chair, in line of the discussion that is going on, I think we can take a decision in our preceding meeting. But if later new evidence, or even afterthought comes that questions the position that we have taken, I think we should be open to say, look, we've got new evidence that the decision we took was not actually accurate, and as a result, let's adapt it, let's adjust it a bit. We shouldn't be like hard and fast rule, even when, according to practice, changes must be made. So, I think in view of what Mrs. Chilen is saying, obviously, that says to us, look, we should invite the minister if he can come that this time, but must also bear in mind that there are this Wednesday cabinet meetings, and actually it might not be possible for him to all come. I'm also in the same spirit saying, indeed, when the minister can come, we should actually take that opportunity that he must come.
Honourable members, you would agree with me. This is a matter for committee. Matter has nothing to do with the people on this side. The idea of the committee not getting this side to complete their presentations is unfair on us continuing what we are supposed to be discussing. And I think Honourable Bajoli is correct. She says it's too late, and we must discuss whatever it is that we can discuss. I would appeal to all of you that we proceed to the next point. We've heard all the points. For the record, I want to say I've broken absolutely nothing, and that we should move to the next point and then deal with the last presentation that you have made, that you are about to make. And then we'll see what happens at the next point. There are some members that are going to leave also, and I think that's my problem also, that the forum on this side is going to become less. We will not be able to deal with a range of other reports that we need to do also. So, DG?
No, thank you very much, sir. This one is in respect to the forensic audit report and the construction, education and training sector, of which I think it would be fair to give over to forensic specialists, because I'm none to take the meeting to those issues and thereafter engage in whatever pertinent questions that would be coming from the honorable members in this regard. Can I give over to Mr. Lumka to present also the service provider who conducted this investigation is also present. Advocate Malazi, her name is Malazi, that was next to me as well. So they will assist in answering the questions in respect to what actually happened, how this was done. Thank you.
Thank you, DG. Honorable Chairman and members, I'm not a specialist, I'm the Chief Director of the Department. But I'm presenting this report on behalf of the Department, and DG has correctly indicated. Advocate Khalida Ismailazi will answer the questions. Let's just present the report as it is in the department. Then the presentation is going to follow this outline. We'll look at the background first, and we will inform you about the terms of reference that were constructed, and also check the summary of allegations and the methodology of the investigation as well advised by the investigators, and reports to the anonymous email and meeting with Nahau and the summer of finance, and subsequently will deal with the recommendations. Now, background. Around about April 2015, the department were inundated with a lot of emails, anonymous emails. Let's emphasize that from various sources and in indicating various allegations, and all of those allegations then were included in the terms of reference that subsequently developed. Now,
In July 2015, Khalidis Malak was then appointed by the department to lead this forensic investigation to test the veracity of the said allegations. Now, 8th of July, the department led a meeting with all staff at Construction City in Midrand to introduce the Khalidis Malak and explain the nature and the purpose of the investigation. It was in that meeting where we requested all the staff to cooperate with the investigation. And also, anonymous email was created to protect the identity of individuals who submit any information regarding all the allegations that were made. Now, let me take you through these terms of reference. What is the nature of the terms of reference? Now, we requested the Khalidis Malak to investigate these anonymous allegations covering a number of matters, and specific terms of reference, we formulated them to cover the broad terms in the following areas and entities. One, the issue of procurement in relation to JSK consulting, and the issue of procurement in regard to Africa-wide consulting as well as Ndumiso Boy. Now, again, the projects that were funded in which S employees, Mr. George Baker in particular, he was involved, and other projects that were funded in which deaf employees were involved, alternatively, which should not have been funded to begin with. And these are the terms of reference that we constructed from the anonymous emails, because there was nobody who came to us that we could ask some further questions, but we felt it was necessary. But what are the gist of the allegations? The gist of allegations related to the previous administrator and CEO that had personal interest in all these entities. And you read all those emails, that was the allegation. Again, the issue of JSK consulting, that he was appointed in violation of procurement prescripts. And Africa Wide was appointed in violation of procurement prescripts. And it did not achieve what it was appointed to do. And again, it was indicated in what we got from those anonymous emails and we formulated terms of reference on, was that there was no due process in the appointment of entities related to Mr. George Baker, who had this finding against him in the forensic investigation, that some entities had been awarded projects when they did not have capacity to deliver, nor office to provide training, and further that some of them were previous employees of either CETA or other CETAs. Now, we then gave all these terms of reference to Khalidis Malak to conduct investigation, and they advised us as a department of the methodology that they were going to go to. Now, the first phase, according to them, was the identification of documentation that would be required. And this produced about 7-8 archivized of the original document. And again, the first phase also entails the interviews with the CFO and other members of the management. Then the second phase of the investigation was then the reviewal of those documentation that they had received, which then included additional 35 liver archives, which were delivered to them. Then last, in terms of their methodology, was the interviews that they had to conduct with the CEO. Now, the reports to the anonymous mail and meeting with now. Now, CETA employees, all of them, were assured that by Khalidis Malak that there's anonymous email that has been set up in their offices for them to report on the terms of reference of the investigation. Whatever issues that the staff members had were given this anonymous email so that their identity could be protected. Now, the emails were received less than anticipated, given the frequency of the emails that was received from April up to July. One of the anonymous emails suggested that the reason why they were not receiving information anonymously was that employees had been asked to sign a confidentiality undertaking after the investigation was announced. And we wanted Khalidis Malak to investigate that if there has been any intimidation, and we'll deal with the findings later. Now, all the emails that they received, they repeated the same thing. If you look at all the emails, it would be JSK, it would be Joshua, it would be Africa-wise. So there was nothing new even in the emails that subsequently were received. Now, the original chairperson of the House
who were accompanied by four staff members who were either dismissed or suspended, also went to make a presentation in person. And they were in pains to point out to them that their type of reference did not include an investigation into the employee-employer matter. Because according to the report that we got from Khadenis, when Nahao and other staff members made the presentation, all that they dealt with was the employer-employee relationship, which had nothing to do with the terms of reference that we set up. And remember, when we constructed, as I indicated, the abuse of power by the CEO was in relation to the procurement of the first providers that we are going to deal with in the findings. What is the summary of findings? Felonist Malazi could not find any evidence of personal interest by previous administrator and the CEO in the entities which form the subject matter of the investigation. But everything that we got was related to the abuse of power by the CEO and the previous administrator in terms of the procurement. And on this one, then the investigation could not find any personal interest of the two. The appointment of JSK consulting was irregular, and the tender was not awarded to the bidder that scored the highest point. Now, on this particular service provider, there were about three areas, because the allegation was that this consulting company was appointed so that the management could have their own people to drive their so-called mandate. And the finding was that all people that were appointed through the use of this consulting company were people who were qualified, and there was nothing related to the mandate. And again, the other issue was that this company was appointed, yet there was a capacity within the HR of the sector. And the finding was that there was no merit of this, because at the time, there was only one person in the HR, and the amount of work that this company had to do was too much. Now, then, there's no merit, however, in the second that she's had capacity to perform the first, I think I've explained that. And the other one, the appointment of Africa-wide consulting was regular. There was nothing irregular in this one, so here's the finding. Now, the conclusion, because the conclusion of the service level agreement between CETA and Africa-wide did not violate a procurement prescription. Just to summarize, Africa-wide was appointed. It had some deliverables, but in the midst of the contract, there was a new SLA that was entered into, reducing the amount of work because the CETA is full of capacity. So that's why then the finding is that, look, here, there was nothing wrong. However, the issue of changing the contract, in the midst of the contract, the suggestion by Malafi, Khadinez Malafi, that is not desirable. And the manner in which Africa-wide render services to the construction sector amounts to an abdication of the board's responsibility to adjudicate application. Africa-wide was appointed to push then the applications for discretionary grants. And what the report indicates is that they would do the evaluation, and the evaluation will be presented to the board in the morning. And I guess the explanation which the staff would explain as to why the applications are given to the board in the morning. But then suggestion from the investigators is that that one is something that needs to be looked at. In relation to Kenton and Ms. George Pepper, then the finding is that the city should have been aware that there were findings in the forensic report of AFF consultants and has refrained from doing business with George Pepper. As for BNB management and Mashala, many service providers were eliminated in the procurement process, resulting in the awards of these entities which were intended by George Pepper. But the process that was followed, there was nothing irregular in terms of the process that was followed. Then George Pepper and one, in relation to normal trading, there was insufficient documentation that was provided to support the issuance of purchase orders, and therefore the payment of this expenditure would therefore be regarded as unauthorized and irregular. And in relation to Kalkwai, Khadenis Malazi Adenis were provided with incomplete records, and on the face of it, the training provided Adenis with Kalkwai has expired, and as did the lease agreement of the training facilities. Now, continuing with the summary of findings, they could not find any irregularities in the tender for the training or community skills development facilitator to PMA Holding. And the other issue, there is no merit in the allegation that Ndumiso Vui Incorporated was paid by CETA to represent the CEO in a divorce litigation. In fact, the allegation was that Dumiso Boy was provided with help because he assisted the CEO in her divorce. Then the facts that were presented to us was that in fact the CEO processed the divorce way before even joined the CETA. She even joined the CETA. But the briefing patterns of Dumiso Boy indicates that they received more, but there are some reasons which have been provided as to why Dumiso Boy got more work than other panel of attorneys that are in the services of construction CETA. Now, coming to the recommendations. Now, in the light of the findings, certainly, Malas, the attorneys, makes the following recommendations. That the appropriate action should be considered in relation to the appointment of JSK consulting. And that would start from the BEC, because the BEC, in terms of the report, made the recommendation for the appointment of JSK, and the BEC made appointment to PAC, and it was the PAC that made a recommendation to the CEO. So the CEO made the recommendation to the board. So that is some actions, which then we'll have to define what those actions are. The recommendation is that they should be taken on all that were involved in making this recommendation. The relationship between the CETA and Africa-wide consulting ought to be reviewed by the board. Consideration should be given to the new procurement process, and the report to the board should be presented well in advance for the board members to interact with. And that's the recommendation given. The board should consider developing a policy that deals with it, with prescribing conduct of business with SMEs, with the sector, education and training authority environment. This should ensure that those who have exited the environment as a result of wrongdoing or alleged wrongdoing are disqualified from taking part in the grant application. The speaker should refrain from amending the terms of and conditions of the contract awarded to a successful bidder without having to go out and tender. The CETA needs to develop a standard operating procedure for procurement of legal services. The self-procurement process in relation to training providers need to be audited more closely. Either we may request the Auditor General or Internal Audit Function to review APs which formed subject matter of the report and make recommendation on how to tighten the CETA procurement processes. In fact, in those service providers were audited by the AG, but now what they are recommending is that some policies need to be reviewed. But even now this one is outside their terms of reference, they offer this gracious advice to the board to consider some intervention to improve the relations between the CEO and the employees of the construction sector. And that's where the story ends.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. Before I allow hands, just to say to you that there was a letter that was sent to my office on this matter that came from the UDM. It's not a letter that asked that the committee must do anything. It was simply informing us that they've referred this matter to the public protector and asking the public protector to demand access to the forensic investigation. I thought I must say that he didn't ask us to do anything. Honourable Bazzoli, Honourable Kassim, Honourable Killian, and we welcome the Deputy Minister who did attend an apology earlier on and who did say that he was going to come later to the meeting. Welcome, dear.
Thank you, Chair. I'm dealing with this issue is unbelievably complicated, as all of you probably know. And we've had real problems with it, and I think the department has as well. I constantly get messages, requests for meetings, anonymous emails with letters, with names, complaining about the CETA. And if I could just explain the three areas that this occurs and see whether that helps us to develop a way of dealing with this. The first set of complaints, letters, meetings that I receive are about internal issues, which, as you say, forensic reports are not about, but these do seem to be very serious. The latest letter I had said that membership of Nahawu was now being restricted inside the CETA, and that people at a staff meeting were offered
a whole lot of incentives not to belong to Nahawu. They were offered 10,000 rand cash as clothing allowance. They were offered their subsidy for their employee bonds, the repayments. They were offered bond installment assistance, a bursary scheme, and financing of funeral cover, and working half day every Friday. Now, if this is true, this is a serious problem. One cannot restrict union membership in that way. And I think that this is something the department needs to look into. There does also seem to be quite an authoritarian management culture in the CETA, as you saw from the confidentiality agreements that people are supposed to sign. People that I've met are terrified of speaking up, hence all the anonymous emails and letters. So there's a bit of a climate of fear in the CETA, which is of great concern. The second area of concern is in the management of top projects. This is well over a billion rand CETA, and it has in it, I think, something like 540 separate projects that it has to manage, many of them in the multi-millions. 12 million, 15 million, 30 million, these kinds of amounts are given up. Some of them are given to organizations that the department itself manages, like TVET colleges, for example, and universities, which one would think would be properly managed, although there have been corruption allegations. But there cannot possibly be proper management of that number of projects by an organization of this size. And so my prediction is, out of those 54,000 students in 540 projects, there are going to be very serious problems occurring, and some of the discussions, anonymous letters, meetings, etc. that I've had have been of these kinds of problems, where a service provider is appointed, students are told they're going to get trained, and they don't get properly trained, they don't get assigned as promised, and by the end of the training they don't get any kind of skill that they feel will enable them to get a job. So the whole thing is run on promises and hopes and dreams of people who think that they have at last found a way out of the unemployment trap that they're in, only to be disappointed at the end of the process. And what you're beginning to see is the thesis actually leading to great disillusionment among large numbers of our people, rather than actual support for them. And I should point out, because the committee may not know, that there was an earlier forensic report, not this one, which sampled 20 of the projects in the CETA, 25 projects, and found that 20 of them were seriously corrupt. So we're looking at an 80% corruption rate in an earlier version of the CETA. Now, I am unconvinced, although that rate may have improved and we may only have a 50% corruption rate, I am unconvinced that that rate of corruption inside project allocation has been that seriously reduced. Now we come to this forensic report, where we see we don't get a copy of the report, and I would like a copy. I think the committee deserves to see it. And it looks at the recommendations, given that this is such a troubled feature, the recommendations are very modest. We sort of say, well, there must be consideration given to maybe taking steps. We're looking at serious situation. And I don't see the report on the forensic report as indicating seriousness of purpose in fixing this CETA. Honourable Halimisa's letter, by the way, is about the last forensic report and its relationship to this one. In the last forensic report, done in 2012 or something, Mr. George Petter was mentioned as a corrupt person. In this forensic report, we see that he is now again mentioned as a corrupt person. Now, why has the CETA carried on dealing with him when he was already fingered in the last corruption report? So the relationship between these two reports does need to be looked into. And the other point that Honourable Halimisa makes so interestingly is Mr. Petter's institute, the Can of Pantone Institute, we're given something like 50 million rand, I think. This is the kind of amounts we're looking at here. What has happened to all the people who were meant to be funded by that 50 million rand? Have any of them actually been trained? Have any of them got apprenticeships? Have any of them finished their learnerships? We don't know. We never know what the outcome is
of what happens is our visas. We're looking at working class people who are actually being treated extremely poorly by these institutes. Thank you.
Citizen? I've got a few comments. The first is the previous friendly report that Honorable Pesoli alluded to, the ANF closed out the port. Now, colleagues from the department will remember I raised this question last year when the seat actually came to Parliament, if you recall. Yet still it seems, according to the minister's letter, that this report for some reason has still been vetted. I've got a copy of the report that was emailed. I know you guys also have a copy of that because you guys were copied into those same emails that many of us as members were emailed to. Now, I'm trying to understand what is the standing of that report as well. Is there any action being taken on that? Has it been published? If not, why not? Just give us some clarity because it's all clothed in some sort of mystery, that specific report, and I've read that report, it's a very damning report as well. The recommendations in there are extremely damning. Then there are the issue of the allegedly staff being dismissed, not just intimidated, but staff that has been dismissed, for example, and there's a number of examples, I'm not going to go through everything for time purposes, for example, Rashida Malachi was a contract management officer who was a shop steward of Nehau, who was dismissed in July 2015, and the senior claims he dismissed her drafting a petition, which was a resolution of the union, etc. And there's a number of these kind of allegations that have been made. Now, we've told that this report, or the terms of reference, excludes employee-employee matters, but clearly if there's intimidation and dismissals, there's an injustice that must be dealt with on some level. So I'm not sure what is, either any plan has been dealt with. Are those individuals who have been targeted, do they have any form of protection? But also, Chairperson, through you to the department, it seems to be not just in one sector. The same allegations were made, for example, in the safety and security sector where people were being spied on, phones were being tapped, the chairperson of the board had an office at the CETA offices, etc. You guys were recalled that before that CETA went under administration. Is there some way, and perhaps the department can advise here, that some sort of regulations or amendment to legislation can be enacted that can deal with this on a sector-wise basis where we can learn from these experiences and then put in provisions which can prevent this kind of abuse of power by members of the board and by the top management CEOs that become intimidated, etc., where former board members then take up high positions in an irregular fashion and so forth. If the department can advise on that. And has there been criminal charges laid against these people like Mr. Peter, for example, and others? Because often what you'd find that chairperson is that, and I think that in this instance as well, people that were previous employees or members of the board then become contractors or suppliers. And sometimes when they've been dealt with in one CETA, and for example, I see it's been said, well, it's been recommended that now this must stop, we mustn't deal with these people. Then they jump to another CETA as well. And they start profiting in another CETA in that fashion. Because, I mean, yes, it's in relation to Canton, Mr. George, because the CETA should have been aware of the findings in the forensic report of ANF consultants, and this refrained from doing business with him. You know, what exactly is the criminal charges? Are people, is there a blacklisting being done in the department as it pertains to CETAs where these kind of individuals who are really rotting the system, rotten people, can be, and their associates and whatever, can be completely locked out from any future dealings in this regard?
Any other member?
Yes. Chairperson, I just want to ask one question. Now, in the summary of the findings, slide number 10, the appointment of JSK Consulting was irregular. Now, as part of the recommendation, then says,
appropriate action should be considered in the appropriate action should be considered. I just want to know why is this appropriate action not specified for us to know. Why does appropriate action? What kind of this action? Which is which? Because I thought the recommendation should go far and say what it means by appropriate action. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. That was also my very first question. What is appropriate action? Clearly, those who were involved in the irregular awarding should follow, should be disciplined. Now, honestly, Chairperson, we can't continue like this in the public sector. We can't talk about what goes wrong, but there's no consequences. And in this case, this must be placed before the department. This is one of those entities where the department must identify weaknesses and must take the necessary action. And yes, the speaker has been under administration, etc. But if things don't come right, then it must go back into administration. Because we cannot have this repeat occurrence. And the second point that I just wanted to find, Chair, like really this is very disconcerting. If we look at the recommendations, and specifically on slide 15, the board should consider developing a policy that deals with prescribing conducting business with ex-employees. We can't have this simply for the board of this feature. Where are the protocols that will apply to all boards? Where are those protocols? Has the department not developed such protocols? Have you not made sure that if not the department, have you approached the Public Service Commission to say we need legislation to regulate for a cooling off period of those individuals who move from one entity to the next entity to loot the state coffers and to enrich themselves? There must be a cooling off period. I mean, in other jurisdictions, they exist 6 months, 12 months, whatever they are. But you cannot, there's a very good description, and I just can't remember what it is. They call it javelin throw. Is it something like that? That you throw a javelin, you want to quit, you've accumulated your income, now you plan your exit, but you throw a javelin because now you're setting up your own business, and then your business will be contracting with the entity that you will now depart. Now, that needs to be tightened. It needs to be regulated. So, what is the current position? Does it exist in law? Has the department taken interim measures to stop that? Really, Chairperson, if we look at the recommendations in the end, I think they scratch the surface of what needs to be done. But they need to be tightened further. Because if certain of the CEDAs that we know they're being problematic, if the rot steps in, it becomes an insurmountable problem. And yes, sometimes I think the infighting in these institutions is also, you know, oh, it's just terrible with all these anonymous emails, etc. But we must get and must differentiate between fact and rumor. But once the facts be proved, it must be consequence. And people must be rooted out. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. I've been covered with most of the things that have been said by the colleagues. But with regards to CETAs, I must say that there can be many other issues at play, especially with this one because it's construction. They are, I don't know whether I must put it as tenders or whatever. Yeah. So there will be many other issues at play where you find that maybe someone was bidding and was unsuccessful and then there are issues. But over and above that, when you now go into the recommendations that have been made, I think with those ones they need to be remanded. They are not as strict in showing that we are working. I was just reading this one where the attorney says
he offered a gratuitous advice that the board consider some intervention to improve the relations between the CEO and employees of CETAS. In any workplace, there are policies, there is a code of conduct, really. That's how we work. We, now it's like we are massaging each other, we need to be specific, we must work according to policies. That is what should happen. With the recommendations, I'm not happy. I think we need to rework this in order to show that this is an entity at work. That is my contribution. Thank you. I wanted to answer the misogyny part.
The Chairperson, there was just one more question. The Honourable Balin Kirelak put in a parliamentary question, I have the date with me now, and it was specific, one of the sub-questions was specific about lifestyle orders. I don't know if that's been considered in this regard, which I think it's appropriate, where there are these individuals, specifically members of the board and their families and so forth, where they try to make like a family business and how people suffer as a result. I just wanted to get the input in that regard. That's our orders.
I don't see any other hands on the comments, but before I give back to the department, in case the Deputy Minister also wants to speak, we do have members from the board here. Both the CEO is here and also the chairperson. I would imagine, on the members, the reason why we've asked them to come here is so that they also speak. And I think there's a number of questions that have been put, and some of that, I'm not quite sure if it's the department must answer them, but rather the entity should answer them. So I want to ask the entity to speak first before there are any answers on your side. Ms. Trele and Ms. Felisa, I'm not sure which one of the two.
Thank you, Chairperson.
I'd be interested to know what happened to the recommendations thus far. Has it been implemented? Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. It would be disastrous for us as a sitter to begin to try and answer, especially on the report, because we don't have the copy of the report. We've seen the recommendation, and it was presented to us last time, and we haven't seen the report as the sitter. One, two. We feel that we need time to sit down and process the report so that we are able to give a full response, especially on the findings as well as the recommendations as set up by the ladies Malashi. We haven't seen the full report, and we at the stage we feel it will be improper for us to begin to try and answer, especially on the findings as well as the recommendations on the report itself.
But I heard a member saying that there was another forensic.
We can safely say,
of course,
we can understand the chronology of.
Okay.
Yeah. No, basically, in respect to this matter, one, the tools that as the department we have in respect to our oversight on entities, that is set up in this instance. One, is AG. Second, when there are pertinent allegations that approach to our attention, we look at those and work out the mechanisms of investigation as prescribed by Skills Development Act. And in this instance, when these allegations cropped up, we approached the entity into saying, our view as a department I don't think it would be proper for the boss to undertake that investigation on the activities of the speaker in respect to these allegations. It would be quite advisable to be the department that undertakes that exercise, which perhaps is a demonstration that we don't relate either to institutions or entities as we wish. We follow the due processes of law. That's how then, as a department, we undertook the investigation, of which I will give over to Helenese Malatsi to answer all those questions in respect to investigation as well as recommendations. But I wanted to point out that the theater in the around 2010, 11, there were a lot of things in respect to financial management that were happening in the entity. We then invoked the processes of Section 14 as well as 15, respectively, to intervene in the theater and put it under administration. The administrator undertook investigation, which is the report that the honorable members are talking about, the first report. And subsequent to the findings of that investigation, there were actions that were taken by the then administrator in the entity. And that process then culminated into the reconstitution of the board and normalization of the functioning and processes of the state. So you have pre-administration, what triggered the department and the minister to put the entity under administration. Then you would have during administration period and the activities that were undertaken by the administrator and implementation in respect to all those areas that were in the office. Then you would have post-administration. And this is post-administration that we are talking about. So of which I would give it over to Advocate Malatsi to answer to the pertinent questions that are raised. In respect to SASEKA is currently under administration. The investigations and the quite a number of actions that have been undertaken by the CEO. Yes, of course, one member, I think there, if I may share with the honorable members, apparently went to another CEO, and the administrator brought that to the attention of the respective CEO that this is the situation in respect to this man. So that member served the administrator of the CEO with papers of defamation. Yes, it's important to understand these issues. But the administrator is dealing with that. All these matters, we follow them through, and our processes of dealing with them, and these are the engagements that we are confronted with. There is none which is being said at the present moment. So nobody is left, you know, out of the group, whether left the seat or in that respective seat. But of course, we are a constitutional democracy. It's not about how you feel. It's about how you are directed by the legislation and the constitution into relating to individuals who may be implicated, of which in respect to those individuals, you have to engage with that process informed by the promotion of Administrative Justice Act. You don't just go to an individual. There are due processes. That part that is stipulated. So you have to comply with those to the latter of the legislation which is applicable and the constitution, I suppose. But let me give over to the expert to respond to the questions that have been asked.
Thank you, DG. Honorable Chair and members, I get a sense that the gist of the questions relates to
to the recommendations. And in a way, there's some disconnect, I get a sense, of the recommendations vis-a-vis the presentation on the findings. What I propose to do, Honourable Chair, is to take each one of these recommendations and unpack them in the light of the detail of the findings, with your permission. If we were to start with the first one, that deals with appropriate action to be considered in relation to the appointment of GHK Consulting. The finding is there was a bidder who scored the highest point. That bidder was ultimately not appointed. Let's not forget that Preferential Procurement Framework Act and Regulations does permit of an appointment of a bidder other than the one that scored the highest point. An explanation has been provided, and the detail of which is in the report. And obviously, in the limited time we have, we haven't put in those detailed findings in relation to that particular procurement process. An explanation is provided by the CIPA itself to say why it's deviated from awarding the contract to the highest scoring bidder. We have assessed that explanation, and we have found it wanting, in the sense that we think that of the three factors that I listed there, they would have difficulty convincing an adjudicator on whether, you know, they actually met requirements for deviation. I'm pretty sure they'll contend otherwise, if and when they're expected to respond. The recommendation couldn't be put any higher than what we've done. In other words, the appropriate action is you look at the practices within the supply chain management units of the CETA in relation to this specific one and allowance, and you consider whether there is any wrongdoing which is deliberate, which can justify, for instance, disciplinary measures. We're not in a position to make that determination. Second, it could be a matter of you offer better trading to those who are involved in BEC and PAC. That's not appropriate action. And thirdly, it could be a matter of assuring that their policies are revised and updated and speak a lot more to under what circumstances would you justify in awarding to a bit other than the highest bid. Hence, we have cast the recommendation in the manner that we did. In relation to Africa Web Consulting and MEP, in relation to the second recommendation on Africa-wide consulting, again, when you interact with the report, you get a sense of why the recommendation reads in the manner that it does. What the CETA has done is it has created an ability to deliver on assessment, evaluation, due diligence investigation into applications, which ultimately produces tons of paper by way of a recommendation report on what to fund and what not to fund, and so forth. And our suggestion is that the reason provided for why the board is confronted with that report at its meeting is one that is understandable in the sense that given the nature of the beast, you want to protect board members against undue influence in the adjudication process. So the method that has been chosen is one that sees the recommendations being presented and the board interacts with it and makes a decision in the manner that they do. Our suggestion is, because it is the accounting authority that given that particular specific institution, they might be criticized for having abdicated that responsibility to this body, given the fact that they digest quite a serious amount of information face to time. So we suggest to them that A, the relationship needs to be reviewed, it's been around for a long time, and B, in doing so, they should consider whether they shouldn't find another way of quarantining board members perhaps for a week or whatever, so that they can probably interact with it. So that is in the nature of that particular recommendation. Honourable members have asked questions around Mr. George Peter and dealings within the sector, CETA's case by persons who have been found to have done something wrong. The only legislative framework that currently exists in our country is the blacklisting framework. So you get put on what is called a national list of defaulting tenderers. In other words, you've done something horrible to the government in some or other respect, and you've been listed as such. So once listed, all entities and all government departments will know you and not do any business with you. Outside of that framework, we are suggesting that there should be processes which the CETA itself puts in place
to ensure that it doesn't suffer from doing business with someone who, in the face of it, has been found guilty of wrongdoing. And again, what's important is there will have to be a post in that policy, in the sense that if you're not going to do business with me because you believe I've done something wrong in the past, you're supposed to follow due process, be noticed as such, I entitle allegations, I respond to them, and you take a decision. And if I'm unhappy with pushes all the substance of the reasons for your decision, I'm entitled to then take it to court on the case. So that's the kind of recommendation that we have in mind under bullet three. Then on the amendment of the terms and conditions, again, when you interact with the body of the report, you realize that what they've done, as Mr. Lumka indicated, is to take what was a very large contract with about 10 deliverables and say, after a year or two, we now have capacity to do these things, sell these things ourselves. So we're going to negotiate basically the scope down. And this is done in the middle of a contract, say a 3 or 5 year contract. And in fact, as a service provider, I say, no, I'm holding you to a contract for the value that it is and for the services that you contracted me. They have now managed to negotiate that contract down to significantly reduce the number of outputs for the service provider in question. And we said there's nothing irregular about that. In fact, it was prudent that they did so. The only difficulty we have is that they may have deprived the sector of a competitive bidding process, you know, out in the market. And they may have found somebody who might be able to provide the same services, perhaps at a better price, in a better capacity. So we've suggested that kind of a practice is undesirable. And it is undesirable because there are times when it goes up. So where those are most of the instances that we see where the contract is negotiated up midstream. We've also, in relation to legal services, again, the explanation in type to the report is that, as a matter of coincidence, this law firm head offices goes by, and secondly, the largest chunk of work to be done by legal firm for the construction sector is the conclusion of contracts, you know, with the training providers, with people that have contracted the payments and so forth. And this one particular law firm got a chunk of the work because that's the specific work that they did for the CETA. What we've criticized them for is that you then deprive yourself again of the potential for experiencing other, perhaps more efficient, perhaps cheaper service providers in the legal space. You have appointed them to a panel, so there should be a policy that's developed which enables them to make sure that there's fair competition in regards to that. Nothing irregular in relation to that. But what we said is, in nature of legal services, you want to have experience of more than just one lawyer for the tune of 90% of legal work. In relation to the entities that were named specifically in the anonymous allegations, it should be borne in mind, as Mr. Lunker has already indicated, that as part of the AG's audit process, they do look into a number of aspects of the grant applications that have been accepted by CETA. And the audit process looks at everything that Africa-wide and the CETA itself would have done to arrive at the recommendation. They look at what the accounting authority itself would have done, and they look at whether there has been post-implementation, proper implementation of particular project in line with the application, and that the money has indeed been dispersed in accordance with the purpose which it was awarded to that particular applicant. And what we're suggesting is perhaps a more careful look at this particular aid might perhaps lead to two things. One is it may very well again educate the CETA itself in terms of improving its processes, and secondly, to extend that there may have been certain implementation of the CETA, the aid might be able to look a little bit more deeper into those and determine the regularity or otherwise of those awards. Then on the employment, in relation to the employment environment within the city, and I hear the honourable member's point about there should be a policy about this thing. But here what we're suggesting is perhaps one of the things that members have mentioned, which is especially in our meeting with the HAU and the four dismissed / suspended employees. And when you read the actual emails, anonymous emails, you cannot help but sense that there is an environment, a working environment, which could be assisted by some intervention of sorts. And this is not at a policy level. And you do get those people, and I've given the example, we've done it in our organization, just to get a sense of what's happening to your people. There are people who specialize in soliciting information and interacting with employees in an organization so as to get a sense of what is working, what isn't working, and what the employer then does with it is to implement measures to improve relations. So that's what I had in mind there by that gratuitous advice. I think I have handled all of the questions except for one around lifestyle audits. As part of our investigation, because what we do is we do open source searches on the individuals that have been involved in the allegations that have been made. So we did it on all entities and on the CEO and the previous administrator. Now, there's a limit to the extent to which you can conduct a lifestyle audit. As you know, SARS have better capacity to do that. And the intelligence agencies and the police have powers under their own legislation to conduct more in-depth setting what we call closed sources, which you wouldn't be able to do in an investigation of this sort. But our open source searches, those are quite detailed. We do what we call scanner corporate to try and see who connects with who at what level, so forth. Have led us to the conclusion that we've met, which is that there's no evidence of any connection between the CEO or the previous administrator and any of these entities. But if a lifestyle audit is to be conducted, it can only be authorized in the context of a criminal investigation. So Section 205 of the Criminal Procedure Act allows police to look at things, and then the intelligence agency that allows to intercept communications and that type of thing. Chair, I believe I have a list of it.
Jim, anything? Your hands?
Yes, Chair. The CEO wanted to add on the ANF report.
Thank you, Chair. I think I just wanted to add in terms of, and the DJ already clarified the two reports in terms of the forensic audit reports, but to indicate that the ANF report was a report that was commissioned during the time of the administrator, and that in terms of the recommendations, some of these are still being followed up. There are cases that have been sent to the SIU. There have been some criminal cases being opened in some of these cases, so that is work in progress. If I may, just in terms of the issues that spoke specifically to issues relating to staff and the recent anonymous email that was sent out, as members know, as Mr. Lunga indicated, since April 2016 to date, all of these emails have been sent out anonymously. And when the very first email came out, the staff in the CETA distanced themselves from this anonymous email. In fact, as late as last week, when the second anonymous email or another anonymous email came out, staff again distanced themselves from the anonymous email. And the good thing was that the latest anonymous email was reflecting on a meeting that management had with staff, wherein all of these things were said to that management promised staff 10,000, etc. And staff responded to say we were in that meeting. It was a simple meeting wherein we were indicating to staff that the recognition agreement with Nihau said that Nihau had to have 30% membership to be recognized, and the membership was below 30%, and we are now in discussions with Nihau. And we also then put to staff what were the specific demands that were put forward, and that's where the meeting ended. But staff has since themselves responded to that to say they were in that meeting, unlike previous anonymous, where they could not respond to the specifics. I think lastly, I also just want to indicate, in terms of staff that have been dismissed, many of these proceedings started even before the first anonymous came out on 16th of April 2015, and many of these cases have run their course. Some of the staff members have gone to the CCMA, and their cases, not a single case has been found against the CETA. All of the cases that went to the CCMA, one or two are now in the Labour Court, and none of them have been found against the CETA. None of them related specifically to the anonymous emails that have been sent out, as Honourable Kassim indicated. For example, Rashida Malachi, who indeed indicated that she was, according to the version Honourable Kassim gave, that she was dismissed because of an anonymous petition. There were staff members who came and said they were being intimidated by Ms. Malaji in the early hours of the morning, at 5, 4 o'clock in the morning, to sign petitions that they did not want to sign. The former finance manager was also suspended, Karibukhe. Her suspension and disciplinary action came out of the Auditor General's regulatory audit report of last year that showed where the particular staff member, the finance manager, there was a specific list of asset disposals that was approved by the board. The finance manager then disposed of some of her own items that she got lost so that she didn't have to pay for it, that was not approved by the board. And that was no witch hunt or anything of management. These things came out of the Auditor General's report. The same with Halma Laji, who was taken to a disciplinary action because of him not processing WSPs and ADRs. And we got to know about this when one of the levy paying companies, one of our largest levy paying companies, Stephanie Stocks, complained to the CETA about this matter that had been dragging on for a year. And the same with Kensani Zitlangu, who was taken through a disciplinary action after a stakeholder came to the CETA to indicate that she was involved in some fraudulent activity in bribing them for accreditation processes. Then I can go on, even the last one is Lekhatile Mutwa. So the staff members that have either faced disciplinary processes during the investigation were facing disciplinary processes that have nothing to do with the investigations. And as I said, some of the processes started before the anonymous came out, but because of delay process, I just thought to clarify those two matters. Thank you, Chitopin.
I'm looking to see if anyone else that... There's another hint. I apologize, I don't know your name.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Wilson Pepe. I'm the Chair of the Core Business Committee of the CETA and the board member. First, congratulations on your appointment as the Chair of this committee. Mm-hmm. I think you've got your work cut out already. I just want to send a word of comfort to the committee that as the board, when we engage with this report, we are going to implement each and every recommendation that is here in this report within the applicable laws with due regard to the rights of all individuals concerned. I just give you that comfort. Thank you.
Okay.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson, and apologies for I'm late now. I hear the CEO Construction CETA was talking about emails from anonymous people. I've also received a note from an anonymous person telling me that there was a bit of discontent earlier regarding my absence. Now, I must place it on record, Chair, that I did tender my apology, and I did say that I will join the meeting late. But Chairperson, let me remind the members, and I'm glad, Chair, that at least you are privy to this information, that members of the relative are members of the portfolio committee, and that were not expressed here, and therefore they are not expected to attend every sitting of the portfolio committee. We attend as per invitation, but as well at Wednesdays, a cabinet day, so we are expected to attend cabinet clusters, cabinet committees, and we serve a number of ISCs, inter-ministerial committees. But of course, we account to Parliament, we must attend committee meetings as and when we are called to do so. But we must strike a balance, Chair. And I really want to implore on you as the Chair, perhaps to restart this, or to initiate or to sponsor a discussion in your Chairperson's forum
around this matter, so that Parliament and the leader of government, this is the deputy president, you know, discuss this matter and to find some common ground, because if there is this illusion that the minister and I must attend every sitting of the portfolio, it won't happen. It's just not practical. But Chair, we must strike a balance. Definitely attends to our responsibilities as members of the executive, but equally come to the portfolio committee as and when we are required by the committee. I thought I should just, but there is a need for Parliament and for the executive to sit down and thrash out this issue so that there's just no confusion, because we don't want to miss for some of the portfolio committee meetings because they require members of the executive to be there. But equally, we cannot say we will not attend meetings that are convened by the head of the executive. Chair, but thank you very much, Chairperson. I think insofar as I came in late and Mr. Lumka was presenting on the CETA. I think it's a process, Chair, and we have not been given the sense of comfort by the board, but obviously now that they have to do certain things, they will do these things within you know, the framework of the law. So the process must unfold, Chair. But I think, I'm not sure if I heard Professor Pozoliwe, Honorable Pozoliwe. I think it is rather irresponsible, Chair, to assume that the CETAs are not making you know, a significant contribution to skills development in the country. And also to brush or to paint the CETAs, all the CETAs, with the same brush. Of course, there are a handful of CETAs. And I'm not saying this specific CETA is one of them. A handful of CETAs that are still ailing. There are many others who are doing extremely well and who are making a significant contribution to skills development in the country. So, but where we've picked up or where we've come to some realization that some of these entities are not doing well, and not living up to the expectation and all that, we have, you know, acted accordingly within the prescript of the law and all that. Then we continue to do this, as the DG already indicated, that where we see that now we must come in, we do so. Of course, by engaging the board to do certain things or by invoking certain sections of the law in order to bring some bit of sanity and stability in some of these organizations. Chairperson, let me close really by thanking you and thanking the committee for granting the department the opportunity to present its performance during the second and third quarter of the 2015-16 financial year on financial and non-financial information. Okay. So, Chair, the APP that or that which was presented earlier obviously serves to implement the 2015-16 vision for the department as contained in the electoral mandate of the card administration and in our white paper for post-school education and training. But otherwise, Chair, we thank you and we obviously rely on your support for the implementation of the plan that you you know, successfully engaged earlier, and we thank the members for the robust discussions. I was not here, but I can imagine, knowing this committee, that the engagements may have been quite robust, but helpful for us and for the department as we forge ahead in implementing many of the things that we had said and that we committed to do to our electorate. Thank you very much.
Thank you, dear.
I can see there's a thing between two of you, and I hope that you're not going to respond to the deputy minister now. You see the two of you. I'd like to be
evident.
Okay, proceed.
Oh, I'm not responding to the deputy. He just knows he must deliver my suit by the time. We'll get to the point. Chair, I want to thank the department for the responses that they have given. But there were questions that were raised that I'm not sure if they were adequately dealt with. It was raised by Honorable Celia and myself and others as well with regard to how can some of these recommendations be taken in terms of protocol or in terms of regulation and legislation so that we can use these learning experiences, the recommendations of these reports, and apply them across the CETA landscape. Now, I know that, if I understand it correctly, the CETA landscape is still with cabinet, the new CETA landscape, that's the Deputy Minister can advise on that. But it was just to get a response on that in particular. How can we prevent, because this is, and we've never said, Jefferson, that it's all the CETAs and that all CETAs are violent, but we've never, I have no proper solution to say that either. But there are CETAs where you see the same problems and the same type of issues are cropping up, and if they can be dealt with at that level to prevent it happening in the future, we wouldn't be going back and forth with this CETA and that CETA. And it costs money. When there's administrators, it costs money. When there's reports and investigations each time, it costs money for that to happen as well. So prevention in this case would be better than having to go up and down in these matters, Chairperson. And lastly, and the question wasn't answered really specifically, I know that the DG did say that they were looking into this allegation about people signing confidentiality agreements. I think this should be a simple matter. Were people required to sign confidentiality agreements which could obstruct the investigation or not? You know, if we can just get some clarity around this.
So, Honorable Julia? Chairperson, you will recall that I wanted to just throw a question of clarity. Thank you very much for the service provider, Master Soldier, for explaining. Now, check, usually in a presentation, obviously, you can't put everything in there. But I still believe, if I may say so, that if you look at the summary of the findings, there is a little bit of a disjunction between the summary of the findings and the recommendations. And I do believe that that needs to be clarified. So, just to mention one, and that is, if we say, yeah, it's understood that the tender was not awarded to the bidder that scored the highest bid, we understand that. But the way that it is framed and sort of formulated here, it says it was irregular. Now, clearly, if you have found that it was not awarded to the highest bidder, and the board should be asked questions as to what the motivation for the awarding of the tender is. That's something different. But if it's stated is irregular, then clearly that gives you a different context. So I think what we just need to do is to clarify specifically what is irregular, what needs further investigation. Again, the market trading, payments, insufficient documents were provided to support the issuance of purchase orders. The payment of the expenditure could therefore be regarded as unauthorized and irregular. Who's responsible for that? Where was the supply chain management weakness? Who signed off on that? There must be consequent management. Sometimes, very first instance, is just a warning to say, you've done this, at the next occasion, there will be further steps taken. But unless we follow through, Jefferson, and that's the concern, when we make findings, the recommendations must follow logically that there will be action taken. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Members. I'm not sure if all of them should be answered, but rather, because I think the Members made a number of questions but also suggestions and the members have also expressed the view on, you know, the recommendations and so on. Now, none of the members said, okay, after you explained, to retract. And so it means they're still of the view that the recommendations are not sufficient in what you brought here to us. So I want to say that maybe we should take that back. The union members have expressed themselves and they have looked at it with different angles on that. And then take into consideration what the members have expressed. Because some of the legislation that you are talking about on the members are not necessarily within this department. But they are in the public service. They are there, and so you have to go to those acts. There was an act that was recently done from public service also that spoke about how officials need to conduct business and so on. And, sorry, and I think you have to come revisit all of that. When you go through the Public Finance Management Act, it stipulates very well how you deal with supply chain management and all the sticky bits and all of those things. Sorry. So I think those are the things that the members are asking that you have to go back to, because don't feel satisfied that sufficient areas have been looked at. We must thank you for the response that you gave.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think you have given guidance as to how we should be concluding the matter. But of course, there's the renewal of the land fee, which is currently taking place at the present. And from the standpoint of the department, there is no entity that has ever been spared when wrongdoing is happening. But you have to address that within the framework of the law. Because as a department, we are not immune from being litigated. Some sitters have litigated us in other places. They've taken us to court. So you don't just, because you have received an anonymous letter and you go to a sitter, you know, you hammer everything. No, there is legislation that is guiding everybody what to do under what circumstances. So we are mindful of that and we comply and we act quite decisively and assertively in all incidents. But I think it's quite important that the honorable members should appreciate projects by sitters being given to the colleges and universities for training. It's very much important. If now as members you cast doubts when these funds are directed to TVET colleges, through universities, by sitters, I don't know what you are saying. It would be better if you clarify that to us so that we understand what are you actually talking about. Because we firmly believe that it is a good thing. That's what we have addressed in National Skills Development Strategy 3 in AgriFair, that using this money solely for programs that are kept at NUF level 1 to 3, it's not in the interest of the learners who are in programs. And we don't think it's a cost-effective manner in which these funds should actually be utilized. We would be happy if it's clarified. Well, of course, our legal services is looking at the report with a view of determining what we need to do as a department in its implementation with respect to the recommendations. What lessons are we learning out of this process so that we are able to strengthen the checks and balances in the entire health chain of skills training and development in the country? Maybe Nade Malad would like to say something as an investigator. We are not investigators. We don't have to. Thank you.
Just on the issue of confidentiality undertakings. In the body of the report, we do deal with the issue. The allegation was made.
An explanation was provided by the CETA, which we found to be excessive. So our finding on that particular issue is that it's a process that started long before the investigation started, and it just happened to be concluded in relation to some employees during the course of the investigation. So the suggestion that employees were made to sign confidentiality and takings so that they don't make interact with us in investigations is incorrect. And we take part your comments about recommendations, but I still maintain that if you had the body of the report, you would understand why the recommendations are what they are. You need to digest the nature of the findings to understand why we couldn't peg a recommendation, for instance, straight out to discipline, sorry, so discipline, sorry. But you need to take that detail into the report. But we take your comments to heart. We'll rework what we possibly can.
Okay. I think on the membership done with one. May I thank the department, may I thank the teacher for I think this and the other presentation. What we are to deal with now, honorable members. Yes, that's what I wanted to say, what we are to deal with now. Does not require the department and the CETA to remain. But the minister, of course, he can let him stay and he must work in the hours that he. He does make up the hours that he wasn't here earlier on and stay. Thank you very much, dear. You can also go. Members, I seek your guidance on the following matters. We have minutes before us, which are minutes of the 19th. There are minutes of April and May. And then there's a list of outstanding reports and the third sub-program. The second program, I think it is a little bit easier. You have a question, Honourable Kriyan?
Chairperson, I just want to propose the adoption of the minutes of the 19th of April.
Honourable members, are you seconding Honourable? Yes. Is there anyone that is against it? Can you make up your mind? Because I'm going to the next minute. April. The bell for the bowl, it seems like it. And Botulian?
I want to propose the option of the minute of the 20th of April.
I'm looking for a seconder. Thank you, Honourable Soon. I'm looking for anyone that's unhappy about the minute.
No,
I don't see anyone. And now, the 4th of May. Show the bill. Honourable Kilian.
Chairperson, this state of minutes is actually
just supposed to register that we came together, but there was no forum, and we could not really proceed with the meeting. So, I don't know how we deal with this, and what is the usual way of dealing with a meeting that convened, but due to lack of a quorum, because it had to take decisions, it could not proceed with the meeting. Is it necessary to have all of this, or it is, okay. If you say so, then I just want to propose that we in fact adopt this. There will be a problem, because it's only the Honourable Gatson who will know, and that what is important for us is just to keep the record. So it's a very simple one that we met, we looked at that, and then we had a discussion, and thereafter decided that we could proceed. So I want to propose a motion.
Yeah, that is accurate. Because in fact, I think Honorable Killian was the only one that wanted to remain in that meeting. I wanted to remain by now, but I don't think that's transpired, because we all are gone.
The minute is a record of the fact that there was a meeting and what the status of the meeting is. That's all on the board. And so I'm moving to the 18th of May. I was ready to move because I see my name in here. That's the 18th of the custom woman at the meeting, they can't say anything. It looks like it's all the minutes in there. Again, I seek your guidance, honorable members, because these are oversight reports that you have done last year already. July, December. The first one is the oversight you did to the Western Cape, honorable Kassel.
I just want to seek guidance from you, perhaps. I know we received these reports on 2 days ago. All of them, these 6 and 8 reports in and of itself, and we're considering our education amendment yesterday. Whether it would be possible to postpone the adoption of these reports to be properly considered. But according to my records, I've gone over them, but to properly consider reports are going to be tabled in the House. If we can seize, look, it's not going to be tabled this term anyways. If we can seize on just these reports, we've adopted the minutes, that's fine, but for these reports, these 8 reports, should be properly considered by the end of our next meeting.
Okay, President, I actually feel that I would like to support the suggestion, and I'll tell you why. They have been distributed in the past, but I've got just a little bit of an addition that I would like to put. First of all, I think when we sit with our planning report, it's appropriate for us to receive a list so that we work systematically through it. You know, the following reports need to be adopted. That's the first thing. The second thing, Chairperson, I must really express my concern about the ability of Parliament to render language service support. Some of these reports have very poor language construction. And it is not appropriate for our committee, which is a committee on higher education, to have a record in the House that has not been very carefully scrutinized to make sure that everything is 100% correct. And since I have worked on a large number of these reports, I was wondering, and it's not copying, it's just spelling sentence construction, you know, making it a little easier. Would the members of the committee object if I hand this to the staff, that they can maybe do the necessary corrections, and then we all receive revised reports that we just check upon return, so that we can process them very easily with a list, so that we can adopt all of them at once.
Any other member? It seems honourable members who are in agreement that we don't deal with these reports. I'm going to ask all of you to send comments then on the report. So you will have enough time to go through it. You'll have 2 months to go through it. And then present them when we return again. So if that's the case, we're moving away from the report. On the committee program, honourable members, we do not have a document that has been prepared on the committee program for the following reasons. We want to ask that what we do with regards to this is, we're not very sure about Parliament's program when we come back after the elections. And to rather find out what's in the program of Parliament and what is then possible to do. Because if we're going to come back for 1 week and then we rise again the next week, you know, it's possible. So we're asking that we hold over this point and that we rather ask, I want to say also other members that, you know, when we come back, hey, this Parliament would be in what I call sort of mid-term. It's midway between the 5 years of Parliament. And I think the committee can do very well in themselves having a bit of reflection of the from 2014 until 2016, the issues that have been dealt with, and moving forward, what are the issues that must rather be prioritized as opposed to looking at this one area and not the other area. So our suggestion is that we rather do that when we come back. We'll have much more clarity about the program of Parliament, and we would have had a session on our own that we would have gone through to take a decision on the program ourselves. You can call it a little workshop, you can call it a, you know, whatever you want to call it. But we are suggesting that we actually do that. Would that be in order, honourable members?
Yes.
Okay. Honourable Cassie.
So maybe as a part of that mini workshop, whatever it is, we've had workshops before as a committee, and I think they were very valuable, and we don't want to repeat that content. But I think what I know, I can speak for myself, is empowerment as it pertains to individual member oversight. You know, what exactly, because I've looked at the parliamentary rules. I got my report to send it to me 2 years ago when I was also kicked out of a campus by a campus manager, TVET campus manager for performing oversight. And sometimes we don't have the resources to go to court and get court orders to allow us to exercise our constitutional responsibilities, which is certainly the case with myself. Maybe just a very small workshop on individual members' oversight, which I think is quite relevant as it pertains to the sector currently, where we want to be on the ground, we want to be doing our work as members of parliament individually, because the committee does not always have time as a committee to go and perform oversight. Also, what are the protocols to give feedback through the committee if we can? I was also reading through how certain things can be sent through the committee chair to the department for responses, etc. All of those things, we've never received any sort of briefing or training in that regard, which I think is quite important.
I'm sure, honourable members, we should just never not have training on the agenda. You know, training can be of very many different. I've learned a very lesson out of this last presentation, and that is probably the last part that you have said. When somebody sends something to you, they say all sorts of things. At which point does that become the business of the committee? For the committee to be informed about that, table it in the committee and so on. Because we have to protect members of parliament also, not becoming the carrier of somebody that has their own agendas on why they would feel they were going to talk to you and talk to you. It does happen all the time, and I think we must protect members in that instance also. The public don't see us as that something that we are not supposed to be. So I think, yes, let's discuss that. and we'll try and outside also to see what there is. But I take it, honourable members, you are happy that we then deal with the thing when we come back and that we have a proper look at the... Don't be shocked when we ask some of you to write things for this little workshop, to do a little preparation on some things, because you are the ones that have been in this committee for a while, and you know best what the issues are, and you know best how to present on whatever issues, and I think that will be quite important to hear your valuable contributions in this regard. Just before I close the meeting, because I think that's the only one, I would ask you, honourable members, if you would agree with me that Professor Jansen is leaving, and we will be in recess. When we come back, I think he's left already, and that we send a note to him and thank him for his contribution that he's made at the university, and wish him well in his new assignment or post or wherever it is that he is going. Would that be in order, honourable members? Okay. Having said that, honourable members, may I thank you very much for this meeting, and thank you very much, I think, for your engagement. Now that this is the last meeting, may I wish you well, and may I ask that all of you have one objective, and that is to make sure that South Africans go to the polls and vote, because that's our responsibility, to make sure that citizenry vote in the elections. When they decide not to do that anymore, then there is a problem with all of us, and that's our responsibility. I intended to say who they must vote for in this meeting, but I would like us to rather say make sure that they, you get everyone to go and vote, and there's nothing wrong for you to talk to them about the ANC. There's nothing wrong.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
Thank you very much, other members. It is you that got him to it.